Well, welcome, everybody. We're going to get the committee underway here. We'll gavel us in, and we've had a request to for us to hear the House File 3363 at the Sandstead Bill first on our agenda today, and we'll move forward with that. So I see we have Representative Sandstead at the table. So welcome, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for bumping me up.
Let me get it in front of me. So I'm gonna move House File 3363 to be in front of us and to be passed and referred to the General Register. So now we're ready.
Please Thank proceed. You. Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House File 3363 is a simple bill that would remove the current requirement that snowmobiles be registered when they are being transported. It's important to note that registration requirements for operation would stay the same. This bill was brought to me by a constituent, and after looking at the statute, I agree with him that this requirement is a little onerous and unnecessary. The state of Minnesota doesn't treat other vehicles this way, not boats, not jet skis, not ATVs. And moreover, as I did my research, I couldn't find the justification for why it was put into effect in the first place. As I did my research too, I was asking for the rationale why we would do that, and we were coming up with no answer. Nobody could really articulate why we're doing what we're doing. And because of that, I wonder if we can't articulate why we're doing what we're doing, maybe we shouldn't be doing it. This law is largely unenforced. In fact, it's enforced so little we can't even put a dollar figure on the repeal of it. It simply doesn't make any sense any longer to require someone to register a sled just so they can load it on a trailer and bring it to a scrapyard or part it out. So I'm not sure that it's really serving any legitimate purpose publicly anymore. When we find laws that are outdated, obsolete, and unnecessary, we have the responsibility to remove them. House File 3363 is one of these bills, and I ask for your support today in moving this bill along.
Thank you, and I believe we have at least one testifier on the bill, Doug Franzen. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen, and I represent the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association. Our executive committee met over the weekend and on a divided vote expressed some concerns on this bill. Fortunately, Representative Sandstead reached out to us. We've had some strong conversations. She's been a little too convincing for my taste, and she's promised that there are ways, and we agree that there are ways to address our concerns as we move through the process without violating what Representative Sandstead wants to do. So we do owe you a debt of gratitude, so thank you, Representative. And our concerns were basically through our registration system, that we're losing registrations, and it's not that less people are snowmobiling. But there are a couple other issues that are large that relate to the loss of our registration. One of them, and I have shared this with Colonel Smith, is unregistered sleds are running on our state and grant and aid trails. And we would like to see enforcement stepped up. Where actually, if you are violating the law, if you are using this resource that other people are paying for, you should pay your fair share. The other piece is, I believe, being addressed, or at least being looked at by Representative Eklund, probably not for this year, but next year. We're going to lose this year about 40,000 registrations because of the antique or vintage law currently on the books. And these are, say, 1995 Polarises. There's a lot of them out there. By law, they will no longer need to be registered to ride on a snowmobile trail. Now, there's a limited window for that, but we have to address that. So after Representative Sanstead spoke with me, I realized we have larger problems than any loss of registration. And frankly, I have never heard of anyone ever getting a ticket for transporting a snowmobile without a registration sticker on it. So with that, we're studiously neutral.
And is there anyone else in the audience that's looking to testify on this bill? I don't see anybody moving. Questions, members? Representative Lute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sanchez. I just got a comment. It looks to me like a good bill, and we got to get it on out of here and process it.
Representative Abey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Colonel Smith. If he, I think he's in the room. If he can come down, please.
Welcome, Colonel Smith, and please introduce yourself.
Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources.
President Pavey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colonel Smith, Representative Sanstead said in her testimony that this is largely unenforced. Can you help me understand what that means? I'm sure that Representative Sanstead can say that as well. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, this law was put into place prior to me being hired in 1997. I asked why we had this law. No one can ever tell me why. It's not something that we've written citations on. For a long time, it seemed to be one of those things where if you buy a snowmobile at Heyday Swap Meet, do you really want to make somebody bring that sled back home? The person trying to sell it, the new owner, going to register it, going, getting it, picking it up and driving it back. And so, yes, it has been largely unenforced, and it's something that just doesn't really make sense, and it's probably time to change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Sanstead also said in her testimony that you can't find a record of an enforcement action taken on this. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we didn't find anything in our records management system over the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're just kind of using your enforcement discretion or whatever to not enforce it. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm guessing that there are times where an officer has seen a snowmobile go by and in the summertime, and they're just using their discretion, yes.
Thank you. One last thing, Mr. Chair, by me. Mr. Franson, you said that those are 1995 Polarises. I appreciate the shout-out, but I know that there are other manufacturers other than Polaris, so thank you.
Duly noted. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3363 be passed and be referred to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to, before we take up the next bill, members, I need to announce that we have a quorum. We've had a quorum for quite a while now, so I need to say that. And I've got some minutes here from the last meeting, February 19th, 2020. If anyone has thoroughly read the minutes and prepared to move
Mr.
for
Chair,
movement.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Lisligard, move the... Is that,
Lippert.
Huh? Oh, sorry. Lippert. Move the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Now we're ready to ride. bill, going back to, okay. Next bill is House File 3376, a Wasluwick bill. Sorry. Representative Becker-Finn, would you move this bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3376, and that it be passed and referred to the Environment Finance Committee.
Very good, and please tell us about your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here today to present three bills that have been developed as a result of what has happened at Water Gremlin over the course of the last 13 months. This first bill that we're talking about today is for a ban on the chemical trichloroethylene, also known as TCE. A lot of you have probably heard about TCE at this point. There was a lot of discussion about it last year and this year when the TCE report came out in January. We did pass a TCE ban bill off the House floor last year. The bill that we're looking at today is something that I, along with Senator Chamberlain, community members, and MPCA staff, worked on after we passed that bill to make the legislation more implementable and more enforceable for the agency. The language that made it into the omnibus bill in the Senate last year but failed to make it into the final budget last session is what we're working from. And the piece of legislation that I'm presenting today is essentially that language with some tweaks to update the timeline and to make it easier for the MPCA to implement and enforce this ban. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about what the bill does, and then I have some testimony from some folks who couldn't be here today as they are still at work that I want to share as well. So just a brief summary of the bill. Beginning in January 1st, 2022, facilities that have air permits with the MPCA cannot use the chemical known as TCE. If a facility needs more time, there is some language in the bill that allows an extension to be granted with certain circumstances met. And the goal really with this bill is to replace TCE with a less toxic chemical. We know that TCE causes cancer. We know that it causes fetal heart defects, and it's something that is very toxic and something that the federal government looked to ban several years ago. Didn't follow through on that, but it is something that they had considered and something that they wanted to do. There are some exceptions in the bill for companies that are using TCE, for example, in a closed system where they're not emitting anything, if they're holding a product with TCE, and then as well as hospitals and academic medical facilities who may use it in the work that they're doing but aren't necessarily emitting large amounts, if any, from their facility. So those are general guidelines. I just want to read a couple of pieces of testimony from some folks from the community that couldn't be here today, had work meetings at the end of the day and weren't able to make it. The first piece is, I think this is in your packets, it's from the Neighborhood Concerned Citizens Group, which is a White Bear area group that was formed shortly after kind of the Water Gremlin news broke in January of last year. The anniversary of the March 1st, 2019 stipulation agreement is almost here. We learned then that our families and neighbors had been exposed to extreme levels of TCE pollution. How extreme? In 2018, Water Gremlin self-reported emitting 120 tons of TCE into the air against a 10-ton per year permit. They had been polluting excessively for 15 plus years prior to that. Our community has been taking action, asking for change, and demanding accountability. We have learned many things along the way that astound us. The White Bear area was not the first community impacted by TCE. This issue has been around for decades. TCE soil and water pollution has impacted communities like Bayport, Fridley, St. Louis Park, Southeast Como in Minneapolis, Edina, New Brighton, Arden Hills, and other communities across the state. These communities are dealing with the expense of managing TCE in the soil and water, and citizens are dealing with health issues caused by TCE pollution. It is possible for companies to move away from TCE. Since Water Gremlin became a media story, MNTAP, which is the Minnesota Technical Assistance Project, has received a record number of calls from companies asking for help to find other chemicals or processes. Additionally, many Minnesota manufacturers have previously moved away from TCE because of how difficult it is to manage, even for those who know how. Another lesson learned, in-person inspections are infrequent. Self-reporting is relied upon, and in the case of serial offenders like Water Gremlin, it puts the community, workers, and the environment at risk when inspectors do not actually have eyes on the facility and do not communicate possible concerns with other agencies. Impacted citizens are not consulted as a stakeholder in large parts of the process. They are not warned when information first comes to light, and they are not consulted as agreements with defenders are being made. The White Bear area community did not want 1,500 trees planted. That was part of the stipulation agreement, including trees on the Watergum and grounds. We like trees just fine, but not in place of hard fines for offenders. The Water Gremlin experience has exposed these issues and others, and I'm sorry to say these issues exist in your communities as well. Take advantage of the fact that through Water Gremlin, we have learned where the system breaks down. We are in support of this common sense legislation, and your communities would be too if they had the unfortunate opportunity to learn all of this firsthand. So this testimony is kind of about the broad package, the three bills we're talking about today. I want to read one more short piece from a constituent who lives in the community who wanted to attend today but couldn't be here. This is also in your packets. I am sorry I couldn't attend in person today. My name is Andrea West. I am a mother of two young adults, a wife, and a homeowner in White Bear Lake. My home, where I raised my kids and where I was living when I got diagnosed, treated, and survived cancer, is in the area around Water Gremlin that has been subjected to more than 15 years of excessive emissions of the toxic chemical TCE. You, our government, have not made sure businesses followed permitted uses of TCE and have not protected my community from excessive toxic TCE emissions. Toxic contamination is not just a White Bear area problem, and high levels of TCE air, water, and soil pollution have been found in many communities around Minnesota. St. Louis Park is a location of a new MPCA plan to create a Superfund site due to ongoing issues of toxic TCE vapors from contaminated groundwater and soil vapor. Communities have also had to pay millions to make sure their drinking water is safe due to TCE and contamination in Bayport, Fridley, Edina, and other communities. You, our government, have not protected other communities from excessive toxic TCE emissions. There is not a question that TCE is bad for human health. TCE has been known to be dangerous to humans since at least 2001, almost 20 years ago. Still, TCE continues to be used by businesses, even though there are safer alternatives to use in its place. You, our government, have not provided enough incentives and support to businesses to encourage use of safer, non-toxic alternatives to toxic TCE. I am asking you to protect me, my family, my community, and all Minnesota communities by banning TCE. I am asking you not to wait another 20 years to ban TCE when we know that TCE is dangerous to human health and is costing our state lives and money, but we do nothing. I am asking you to ban TCE now with a suggested end date to use of TCE of 12/31/2021. Thank you for your consideration. I do want to just briefly mention the folks that we had written testimony from talked a little bit about communities that are impacted by TCE outside of the community in my district. And just wanted to read the list of several communities that some that have already been mentioned that are dealing with TCE water contamination. And a lot of those communities are having to pay to treat their water so that they don't have the TCE being consumed. Those communities include Bayport, Baytown Township, New Brighton, Fridley, Spring Park, St. Louis Park, Edina, Spring Grove, and Wade Park. There are also other communities that are dealing with soil and indoor air pollution as well. Some of those communities and others across the state. So just want to wrap up and say, we did this last session. We had good bipartisan support in the House, and this bill, really what the goal is to make it implementable by the agency, enforceable, so that when we go out and want to ban this, we actually can do it. So this is the bill. This is the language that will help us get that done.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Wadlick. We have some testifiers that have signed up. Aaron Clems. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. My name is Aaron Clems. I am the Director of Public Engagement at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCEA is a nonprofit organization with almost 50 years of experience of using the law and science to protect Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. Representative Wozlewicz's HF 3376 places an end date on the use of a toxic chemical that is one of the most prevalent polluters of Minnesota's air and water. MCEA strongly supports HF 3376. TCE's toxicity is not in doubt. Safer alternatives are available. And the ongoing harm to Minnesotans from decades of pollution demand that we set a firm end date for the use of this cancer-causing chemical in Minnesota. Trichloroethylene has been widely used as a degreaser and a solvent, but it causes cancer even at very low levels of exposure, and that science is irrefutable. This committee is familiar with the Water Gremlin case, where surrounding residents of the factory breathed toxic levels of polluted air for 15 years when pollution control equipment failed and the company did not fix it. In addition to Water Gremlin, though, there are several other large air emission sources that legally release through permits TCE into the air each year. Many of these facilities are located in historically overburdened areas that face multiple pollution sources, polluting the air that they breathe. You may not be as familiar with TCE's impact on drinking water, but communities across Minnesota deal daily with this issue, with the challenge and expense of addressing this TCE contamination of their drinking water. So to provide safe drinking water to their residents, they have to pay millions of dollars to treat this. My community of Fridley is one of these cities, as well as the neighboring community of New Brighton. And it's been a long time, decades-long process of trying to provide safe drinking water to the place that I live. But it's cost millions of dollars. Even the air in our homes and businesses is at risk from this pollution, because TCE-contaminated groundwater can carry TCE vapors into buildings where they concentrate to unsafe levels and harm people's health. And that can harm residents and workers. In just a few months since the MPCA has been contacting permitted users of TCE and encouraging them to adopt less toxic alternatives, five of the largest eight TCE emitters have voluntarily agreed to adopt safer alternatives. And I think this is an important lesson, that we're ready to set an end date for the use of this chemical, because we can do that. We can make a movement toward less toxic alternatives. These alternatives exist. The success of MPCA's voluntary efforts so far to reduce use provide clear evidence that a phase out of this toxic chemical is both timely and feasible and necessary. Even when Minnesota ends the use of TCE, we will have to deal with the pollution left behind for decades, even centuries. So now is the time to stop adding to this toll. Thank you for your kind attention. Chair Purcell and members, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll bring you back if we've got questions here. We'll get a couple more testifiers. Tony Quillis. Welcome and introduce yourself, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to just be very brief and want to thank Representative Wasiluk. I think I saw Representative Fisher earlier. There are a number of proposals out right now, including the administration's. Representative Wasiluk has a couple of them, including the administration's, and there is another one out there, Mr. Chairman. I think that highlight, as you've just heard from Mr. Clements, of the issue in front of us. The PCA, I'm going to use all my acronyms, the PCA did a TCE reduction report, and I think it was very helpful, pointing out that, you know, the facilities in the state, the major users, most of them have voluntarily gone, and it was also mentioned by Representative Wasiluk that the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program, or MNTAP, has been doing a great job in helping businesses transition out of this chemical. But the one quote I want to read you from their website is, unfortunately, there is no silver bullet when it comes to replacing TCE. So sometimes it takes a little bit of time, and that's why I want to thank Representative Wasiluk and Representative Fisher. We've been also including the stakeholder group or neighborhood groups and some of the stakeholder meetings that we've had. And I think each and every meeting we have, Mr. Chairman, is there's been some very constructive conversations. I think all parties will agree. And we're getting a little bit closer every time. We're not there yet, and I don't want to be the one that let perfect be in the way of the good, but I think that we're moving our way towards a solution. I'm hoping Representative Wasiluk agrees with me.
Very good. Thank you, and we'll bring you back if we got questions. We're going to get to all of our testifiers here. And two folks from MPCA, Greta Gauthier and Craig McDonald, and if, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It'll just be me today, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
So thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 3376, the ban on the use of TCE. And thank you to Representative Wasiluk for introducing this bill. Banning TCE is an important step to protecting Minnesota's air and water and is a priority for the MPCA this session. Our preferred position is the administration's language, which, as Mr. Quillis remarked, was introduced today in the House. and last week in the Senate. Both the governor's language, our language, and Representative Wasowick's language are based off of the agreement that everyone had at the end of the 2019 session. And as Representative Wasowick said, we worked on that language over the interim, we, the PCA, to make that language more implementable. And so there are many shared concepts between our TCE ban bill and Representative Wasowick's TCE ban bill, and we definitely support and share the intent of her bill. So I think right now we're looking forward to working with Representative Wasowick and other legislative leaders to come to agreement and enact a TCE ban this year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and I guess that's questions, members. Representative Beckerman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also really want to thank Representative Wasowick. She's been working harder than anyone on this issue since we found out about Water Gremlin a year ago. And, you know, I hear the, well, this was our version and this is our version. And at this point, and to be clear, I have constituents in the Gem Lake area who are also impacted by this pollution for nearly two decades. And those just kind of sound like excuses at this point, as far as it's almost March. Our deadlines are going to be here before we know it, and we need to get moving. We need to do something. That's what I'm hearing from my constituents. That's what I'm hearing from other folks in different parts of the state that have been impacted by this chemical and other chemicals. We need to do more. And so I think it's important that we do move this bill forward, and I know she'll do her due diligence and talk with folks if there's you know, things that make sense. But I mean, we've waited long enough. It's been a year of meetings and all through the interim, and we need to move forward. So I'm hoping that we can move this forward and let a good bill do some good work for people. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'll just very brief. Obviously, it's a policy committee, so and this is going to finance next. So at that point, we'll need to make sure that we understand the cost. Even to take something out of the system, there's cost. So that I just want to make sure that we understand there's some more things we got to look at.
Thank you for that. Representative Pabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like the gentleman from MCA, Mr. Clemens, to come down, please.
Introduce yourself again, if you would.
Sure. I'm Aaron Clems, the Director of Public Engagement at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clems, you said in your testimony that there are substitutes for or alternatives for TCE.
Yes.
Does MCEA have a list of those substitutes?
Representative Fabian and Chair Purcell, no, not off the top of my head. There are a whole host of different alternatives for degreasing agents. Some of them are chemical in nature. Some of them are just water and steam. You know, so there are a variety of them, and I know that the MPCA has been working with permitted users to identify a list of potential alternatives. As Mr. Quillis noted, it's not like there's a single bullet, right, to respond to all of these. That different industries and different uses will require different processes. So I wouldn't want to stand up here and tell you that there's five alternatives and they're all better. But they need to. That's work that needs to be done between industry and the regulators.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, absent of the water and steam, is MCA working on some sort of a list of things that they approve that would be a substitute for TCE?
Chair Purcell, Mr. Fabian, no, we're not. We're not doing that duplicative work of what the MPCA does. The MPCA has been looking at alternatives, as MNTAP has as well, and they're generally less toxic than TCE, but I don't have a list in front of me today that I can give to you, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, then, the follow-up is, are you going to be doing that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Purcell, Mr. Fabian, no. We won't be creating a list for industry to use.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions here? I'm going to ask for, I'm sorry, Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgot to mention, I would request a roll call on this vote.
Very good. And I need to ask anybody in the audience who wants to testify on this bill. Seeing none and no further comments, members?
No.
Yeah, okay, we're ready. Representative Becker Finn, would you renew your motion? And
yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 3376 be passed and referred to the Committee on Environment and Finance.
And roll call being requested. Take the roll. Chair votes aye.
All right. Vice Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Lead Luke.
Aye.
Representative Acomb.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Bowe.
Aye.
Representative Claflin.
Aye.
Representative Fabian.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Heintzman.
Aye.
Representative Lippert.
Aye.
Representative Lizegard.
Aye.
Representative Wagenius.
Aye.
There being 15 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
You heard the roll call there, so the motion prevails and bill moves ahead.
Sounds like a bunch of pirates in here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
That was good.
Good parrot. Okay, you'll get to say right there. Thank you, Representative Wazlowick. House File 3377, Air Emission. Please tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3377 requires the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to require facilities with air quality permits.
1 minute. I need to move the bill. Sorry. I'm going to move the House File 3377 be referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3377 requires the PCA to require facilities with air quality permits issued by the agency to increase the frequency with which air emissions are physically measured. It also requires records of indirect measures of emissions to be sent to the agency monthly. One of the concerns that we heard from a lot of people. So first of all, I think a lot of the general public doesn't know that a lot of our regulatory processes, particularly with MPCA, rely on businesses self-reporting. So relying on businesses to present the PCA with accurate data on, in this case, their air emissions. The case of Water Gremlin brought up a lot of issues in this area, and I'm just going to walk through a few things. You don't have the stipulation agreement in front of you. It's like 30 pages long, but I'm going to walk through a couple things that came up in the stipulation agreement between PCA and Water Gremlin that indicate a need for something more than what we currently do, which is essentially go to a facility once in a while and then look at rely on paper records that the company is providing outside of that. So I think one thing to understand is that the PCA had really no independent data about conditions at Water Gremlin. So they were relying on the regulated party, which is Water Gremlin, their records and documentation to ensure compliance with permit conditions. So just one example from the stipulation agreement, the MPCA relied on VOC performance test and Water Gremlin's maintenance and rebuilding as justification for the equipment's capability. This is pollution control equipment to operate above the required 95% control efficiency and included operating and record keeping requirements in the permit. They had several issues across several years with breakdowns in this pollution control equipment. And over a course of several years, they went out and inspected, and they never really discovered that there was anything wrong with the equipment because, again, they're relying on the company to tell them when they're experiencing issues. They also, when Water Gremlin was, when PCA and Water Gremlin were having a conversation around irregularities in information that they were receiving in 2018. In the summer of 2018, Water Grumman provided some information to PCA that was concerning. And at the September 20th, 2018 meeting, Water Grumman was unable to produce records detailing whether or not their pollution control equipment was operating every day prior to July 22nd, 2018. So we're relying on a company that's supposed to be keeping records and hadn't been keeping records on whether or not their pollution control equipment was operating every day and how well it was operating. So that's one example. There are several other examples in the stipulation agreement that raise concerns about the process that we have right now, which relies, again, mostly on records and documentation kept by a company. I think there's, you know, the regulated party had not kept these records, and so it's hard to understand how we can rely on the records when they don't exist. Another issue that has come up in talking with community members is the same concern that I express, which is that we're relying on a company to provide these records. We have a great example here of a company not even having those records and having a pollution issue for 17 plus years where they were above permitted levels by quite a bit. I think it's important to note that Water Grumman is not an isolated incident. So the final shutdown of Northern Metals, another example in North Minneapolis last September, was a result of a whistleblower at the company reporting to PCA that the company was providing false air emissions readings. Again, relying on a company and having them clearly not reporting correct data. Heartland Corn Products in Winthrop, the state's fourth largest ethanol plant. The plant had not been doing proper performance testing, record keeping, and reporting on the operation and maintenance of its pollution control equipment. So it's a Star Tribune article from last October. New management voluntarily conducted an audit and found that violations had been occurring for almost 4 years. Spectral Alloys in Rosemount. The EPA entered a consent decree with the company in 2012 over violations that occurred between 2004 and 2009, including emissions of dioxins and furans and hydrochloric acid that exceeded federal law and other violations. The company failed to disclose that its own monitoring system revealed excess emissions. This was from a Star Tribune article in October of last year. So something important to note in your packet of documents, why we're looking at stack tests as a potential way of actually getting real data, so not relying on records that may or may not be there, or records that may or may not be false, or records that may have an error. I think one thing to point out is that people do make mistakes in these sorts of situations, and it's not always intentional that companies are doing this, but intentional or not, that doesn't change the fact that people are being harmed in our communities because of these emissions. So there's the document called Clearing the Air, an evaluation of Minnesota's programs to protect the air we breathe in your packets, members. It's from 1992, and it talks about the PCA's stack tests. There's some information in there about number of stack tests and percentage observed, and you can see on table 6.8, the number has been going down. This was, again, in the 80s and 90s. And then stack test policy. So some of the information in here, which is some of the guidelines on page 116, are what was actually used when we crafted this bill. So it's language that is coming from a report about PCA stack tests and the new stack test policy that, from my knowledge, has never been implemented. But I could be wrong on that. To my knowledge, if it has been implemented, it hasn't been actually being done very widely in terms of how many businesses are required to do it. So I think the main point here is that we don't actually, you could go to any company where there's air emissions and we actually don't have a measurement of what's coming out of the stack. We assume that companies are providing us with correct information, as we've seen from Water Grumman and Northern Metals and several other cases, some of which I detailed. This is not always the case. And we really have to have some sort of system in place that's actually getting us the data that's helpful in determining whether companies are, what they're emitting and at what levels to make sure that they're, one, in compliance with permits, but also that they're not causing excessive harm to our communities.
Very good. So we have a couple of folks to testify. Is that you're done telling us about the bill for now?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I have listed to testify Greta Gauthier again and Doug Wetstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Again, it'll just be me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3377. As I mentioned earlier, our goal is to protect and improve the environment and public health, human health, and we are open to any conversation and any legislation to help us better achieve our mission. We did just complete this. This bill is very encompassing, and it would apply to all facilities that have an air permit, which would be more than 2,000 entities in the state of Minnesota, and would require a fairly large staffing increase on the part of the agency. We are not taking a position on this bill because it has budget implications, and agencies are not taking budget positions until after the governor's budget is released to the legislature next month. But I will say that we are open to continuing to work with the author to see if there are opportunities to scope this bill. And that's my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. And would the increases in necessary funding for people, is that because MPCA is going to be doing more of the testing? If that was said, I missed it. But
Mr. Please. Chairman, yes. We just finished our fiscal note, and we had a number. I believe it was over 100 new FTEs, and the fiscal note was upwards of $15 million a year.
And Commissioner, does MPCA do any split sampling on any of these now? That is the...
Mr. Chairman, the answer to your question, I'm looking at one of our scientists in the audience. The answer to your question is no.
Okay, I was wondering what level of was being pursued here. So, okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. I got some questions. Hang on a minute. Some of them might be for you, Commissioner. Representative Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a question for MPCA. As I was following the author's some of the justification for this, are you comfortable that you're looking at the right things on these permits? Or, I mean, it sounded to me like the agency was really being indicted as absolutely not having a clue what's going on. I'll be quite blunt with you. That's what I heard. From the standpoint of, are you looking at the right things? Obviously, the company's responsible for to take those measurements. I mean, you really feel that we just are missing the boat here and not looking at the right things? I mean, obviously, that's got nothing to do with the governor's budget. I'm asking from a more straightforward regulatory question. I mean, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lewick, thank you for that question. I appreciate it. I don't think there is a state agency in existence in the country that is perfect. But I do think that we have a system that many other states also have, which is an option under the Federal Clean Water Act, Federal Clean Air Act, it's late in the day, I apologize, which is for a system where we work with a permittee to set up a system in their facility by which they will meet the air quality standards they need to meet, and then that system continues to run and the entity reports back to the agency on a self-reporting basis. We are not the only state that has that. But that's never to say that maybe things could be better, and we're always open to ideas about ways we might be able to do things better. So I don't think that we are missing everything. I think that sometimes we have data submitted to us and we review that data, and we do make inspections, and there are cases where situations like Water Gremlin, where these machines are encased in huge, I'm not going to say we didn't do anything wrong, but I'm not going to say we do everything wrong, because I don't believe that we do. But we are always open to looking for better ways to do things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as a follow-up, let's just suppose for a moment Minnesota wasn't designated by EPA to regulate this element. Would the federal government come in and take those measurements, vice demand that the regulated entity provide those measurements?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lewick, yes, if the MPCA did not have delegated air pollution enforcement authority delegated from the US EPA, then the US EPA Region 5 out of Chicago would come in and do that work in Minnesota.
Representative Lewick, put a little finer point on it. Would they go in and take the measurements as this bill would provide, or would they demand that as you folks do, that you do a certain amount of measuring and that those records are available? I'm not sure at the periodicity, but are sent to MPCA to examine? In other words, it looks to me like, and you brought the subject up, I know it's not the Finance Committee, but we're talking $15 million and a huge expansion of the agency to go out and be taking measurements and running equipment that it sounds like the industry would normally be doing. So, I mean, I'm very familiar with the designated, undesignated business from EPA, from states where they don't have an MPCA. So what I'm asking is, would the federal government do what's in this bill right now?
Good,
Mr. Chairman,
there are a couple folks want to talk on this, so go ahead.
You bet. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Craig McDonald, to answer that one.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Craig McDonald. I serve as Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy at the PCA. Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick, the EPA would require the company to come in and to report whatever parameters they decided in that permit process and in that permit and report it directly to EPA.
Just one quick follow-up then. And also, are these permits renewed every 5 years, or are these some of those that we talked about earlier so that every fifth year there is a general review on renewing these permits?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick, it depends on the permit. So to be specific, all permits have reporting requirements, but the stringency of the reporting requirement depends on the potential to emit for each permit. So that helps shape what a company has to report.
I'm going to go now to Mr. Ely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there may be some confusion over what the bill requires. And I'm reading now from line 2.8 of the bill, which says each air quality permit. My point is that this does not require the PCA to go out and do testing in facilities. What the bill says is each air quality permit issued by the agency must contain a compliance determination protocol that consists of a list of methods the agency requires a permitted facility to employ to physically measure the actual emissions of each pollutant emitted by the permitted facility and the frequency with which the agency requires the permitted facility to employ each method. So the bill states that the facilities are doing the test as directed by PCA.
Yeah, very good. Move forward here, Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Eliff, thank you for that. I'm still not clear on what's going on in the bill. But that being said, Ms. Gauthier testified, I believe she said that there's about 2,050 permits that are impacted by this bill. So, Representative Wasilewicz, is it your intention that all of those permits all across the state are going to be subjected to what you have in your bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I think as the commissioner mentioned, that we are certainly okay with scoping this. If there are facilities that are putting out more hazardous chemicals or larger amounts, that would be something we would take a look at. As it stands right now in the bill, there are already some guidelines. Let me see where that begins. Under subdivision 4, starting on the bottom of page 2, there are some guidelines around what sort of performance tests are required and how often for different facilities based on certain factors like where they're located, what their permit contains. So we are certainly open to if scoping that a little bit more, making that a little more specific to facilities that are really putting out large amounts of toxic chemicals or very toxic chemicals, certainly making that a requirement. I think the biggest thing we want to get at is we know these toxic chemicals are out there, but we don't actually measure them. And that's a big concern for folks who are being exposed to these toxic chemicals in their communities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wasilik, you said that you mentioned in your testimony Northern Metals and Water Gremlin and one other, and you said that these are not isolated incidences. You also said that there are several other cases where this has happened. Can you give me a list of those other cases that have been?
So let me just find that piece of my testimony here. Here it is. So I think the list, let me just find that page here. The list that we have has three cases plus Water Gremlin, and those were just in the past several months where there have been press about those beyond Water Gremlin. So I'm not sure if PCA or someone else could speak to if this is beyond that, but these are just cases that have happened in the last couple months that we've had media coverage on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and members, I have some concerns about the broad scope of the bill. There's 2,050, and if I'm hearing you right, there's probably 10 that have that probably would fall into that category that you're trying to identify. I just have a lot of trouble with the overreaching nature of the bill. On page 2 of the bill, on line 2.29, you talk about a third party under contract. Who would be the third party?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, the third party would be in the case of, for example, with Water Gremlin, they have a laboratory known as WENC that is a third-party facility that is doing the monitoring and the testing for them as they have this ongoing investigation and follow-up with PCA. So that's an example of who the third party could be. It would be somebody who is capable and who does this sort of work as their job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wasilik, do you have any idea how many of the 2,050 permitted facilities are already using a third party to help them with their monitoring and reporting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I don't know that. A lot of the companies that have permits that are doing this, they generally just do self-reporting themselves. So if it's required, if they have any sort of measurements or documentation, those records and documentation are things that, from my understanding, that they're keeping track of and they're providing to the MPCA.
That's enough for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, the reality is we don't know how many other facilities are breaking the law with their air emissions because we're not checking, which I'm pretty sure is the underlying policy goal of what we're trying to do here. You know, so keeping focused on the policy is, do you let the industry continue to regulate itself and depend on whistleblowers and, you know, happening to catch people or them turning themselves in to know whether this is happening? So I think it is a large scope, but we should be concerned about it. And I think what we heard from folks in our community is that 17 years, how did it take 17 years? Because we weren't monitoring them very closely, because they were monitoring themselves. And so I think how many can you name off the top of your head? I mean, the reality is we don't know what we don't know. And I think that it's good that we're trying to get to the bottom of that. So unless the MPCA wants to answer a question about how many facilities are polluting that you don't know about, which I'm guessing you can't answer, so I won't put you on the spot, but that's the thing we're trying to get to here. So thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would agree with Representative Fabian. This is casting a pretty wide net. And just a quick comment on what Representative Becker-Finn just said. This bill doesn't change the fact that the permitted facility on line 210 is actually the one who is doing the testing. So if anything is changing with that, I'm not so sure it is, because they're still the ones that are required to do this determination protocol. And my question to the bill author is that grain elevators and ethanol plants also have air quality permits, and I don't know how we would measure dust in the fall and bees wings from corn when they unload that in their bunker for a 2 week period. But would that fall also under the authority of this legislation if it were to pass? And is that the type of thing you're looking at in terms of out in the rural part of the state, some of the agricultural workings that are going on there?
Representative Lovely.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's not the intent of this legislation. And I don't know specific every single facility or company that falls under these specific circumstances that we have listed here, but I would imagine that those would not fall under here just given the fact that it's not the higher levels and the really toxic chemicals. So I can't say for sure if that would fall under this, but certainly not the intent of what we're trying to do. We're really trying to go after large emitters and folks who are emitting very toxic chemicals.
Representative Hindman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to piggyback on Representative Anderson's question. I'm trying to figure out, Representative, how can we move this thing forward if we don't know who it affects? And secondly, I'm still confused, and maybe MPCA can help the second part of this question. I'm hearing that the businesses that are going to be affected by this are still self-reporting. So what are the 100 additional FTEs, if I'm hearing correctly, going to be doing back at MPCA?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, the FTEs have to review the data. So obviously when you have more frequent reporting, we still need somebody to go through that data to check it, to determine its validity, to see if there's any anomalies with it. That's part of it, as well as if we do find something, there would be compliance and enforcement staffing as well.
Mr. Chair, I can address another piece of that question, Representative Heinzman. So if you look on page 2, line 2.29, this has a third party under contract to a facility operating under an air quality permit issued, blah, 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 must report the results. So this third party contractor would be reporting the results of the testing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that wasn't my question. I'm trying to figure out, if we don't know who this is going to be affecting, as Representative Anderson was specifically trying, I think, to drive at, how can we be moving this legislation forward? As I thought it was pretty reasonable to try to narrow it out of the agriculture issue, but that couldn't be done, at least in the testimony that I just heard a moment ago. I mean, so if we don't know how it's going to be affecting grain elevators, how can we be moving legislation? I don't understand.
Not sure there's an answer. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heinzman, so if you look in under subdivision 4, it's not that we're not narrowing it. It's that I can't tell you if a specific company would fall under this requirement. I don't have a list in my head of every single company or facility that would fall under this list that would be required to do performance tests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. If it seems like it's pretty reasonable to say that we know this element of our economy wouldn't be affected or would be. We have the bill rate in front of us. I don't understand. I mean, the criteria here can't eliminate that issue, as Representative Anderson brought up.
Representative Guineas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your bringing this bill. This is not about protecting polluters. It's protecting citizens, and this is what we need to do. So thank you for doing that. When we go on to finance, the finance committee, there are a couple of things I'm thinking about that it would be helpful to know. You've given a fairly large fiscal note on this. Isn't there a way, I assume all this is reported by email, and isn't there a program that could be set up to just tag what shouldn't be? And I can't imagine there's not a way for science to do that. That's one thing. So to ask that in the next committee. And also, when folks think, oh, this is a big amount of money to spend, I am thinking about the big amount of damage done in the TCE case and would like to be reminded how much was the fine there that really represented the damage done?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, the fine, the civil penalty fine was $4.5 million for Water Gremlin. Other parameters around the stipulation agreement brought it to about $7 million. That would include the SEP and ongoing monitoring costs.
Just, but that's one company doing one set of damage.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, that's correct.
So if we found just a couple of companies, we would actually maybe be saving money.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the comment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple questions for Mr. Eloff, just since we're walking through definitions here. I look at line 1.14, hazardous air pollutant. So the definitions, I think, are defining in terms of the task. And with the question, is corn chaff considered a hazardous air pollutant, Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't believe that it is.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I'm looking at on line 3.7, a chemical of high concern. So would dust, Mr. Eloff, be considered a chemical of high concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no, would not be.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then even for where there is a emission of a hazardous air pollutant, it has certain. When we go to 1.16, 1.17, 1.18, 1.19, that puts conditions on that. Is that correct, to the author of the bill, Representative Wozlik? It has that the air pollution pollutant has to be in excess of 100 tons per year. Is that correct? So it looks like there's fairly common definitions that are involved here. Relating to the pollutant, and when it has back to 3.7, a facility emits a pollutant identified as a chemical of high concern. So I'm assuming there is a list on 3.8 at the Department of Health of those chemicals of high concern. Is that correct, either Representative Wozlik or Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, now I'm more confused. Because on page 2.8, 2.9, 2.10, it says each air quality permit issued by the agency must contain a compliance determination protocol, which seems to me to be not syncing up with kind of the line of questioning or comments that Chair Hansen was making. So my question to the agency is very simple, very straightforward. And Ms. Gauthier said that there were about 2,050 permits that were impacted by this bill. Does the way you read the bill, does every permit that's issued an air is every facility that's issued an air permit going to be impacted by this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, that is the way our staff has read the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification. So then, does that include, say, a hospital or a clinic or a school or a city that have standby generators, for example?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, any facility that is required to have an air emissions permit would be subject to portions of this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my point is that we've heard about businesses, and we like to get after businesses now and then. But this is also going to impact municipalities and hospitals and schools and those as well, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, anyone who holds an air permit would be impacted.
Thank you.
You put it in here.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it looks just on this line of questioning on 2.8 that each air quality permit requirement is for subdivision to the compliance determination protocol. So that is for determining protocol, whereas the performance tests are not as an inclusive thing because you get into the conditions of where they're required under page 3. So it looks like we narrow as we go through the bill, that there's protocol that's required
and then a smaller subset has the reporting requirements, and then a smaller subset that requires performance tests. If that's my correct reading, maybe I would ask Mr. Eliff if I'm reading that right, because I want to be at least understanding this as well as
Mr. Eliff.
Everyone on the committee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, you are correct in terms of subdivision 4 of the bill, which relates to stack tests. This sets up a schedule as to how often the stack test will be required by the PCA, and it differs according to the type of facility, whether it's a major facility, whether it's putting out hazardous permits or hazardous air pollution, what its most recent stack test might have shown. Those are going to differ for each air facility is going to have a different slot based on their conditions. If they're located in an air non-attainment area, they would be tested more often. But it's also the case that under subdivision 2, the determination protocol goes as it's drafted now, each air quality permit issued by the agency. So there's two different parts. Part one applies to all permittees. The second part depends where those permittees fall within the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that this question is for MPCA. Is this in any way going to impact the manure management rules in agriculture, specifically in confined operations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Look, that is not something I'm aware of. We could get back to you on that.
So, Mr. Chair, the answer is we don't know at this point.
Mr.
And that's really a question for the author, not you. Again, that's a big deal. There's a whole area out there for manure management with some of the confined operations where we do very carefully monitor and control air and odor and all kinds of things.
Mr. Chair and Representative Look, looking over at our staff, it said it would not apply to the manure management. So we got that answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the agency on page 3, it starts on 3.20, facility whose pollution control equipment has undergone a significant alteration, repair, or replacement. I'm under the impression from the people that I've visited with who do replacement, you have to go through a very extensive permitting process to replace equipment or repair equipment. How would that, if you have to do that re-permitting in essence, if you're doing new equipment, first clarify for me, do you have to reissue a permit? I've had this situation a few times in the district that I represent. When someone's going to replace or repair their existing air handling equipment, do they need to re-permit? And what is the process involved in that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, it depends on the extent of the change being made. There are times where there would be an amendment to the permit, which would be reopened, and that would be a permitting process. Depending on other changes to air handling, not knowing specifically what it was, some repairs may not trigger that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last question. So then, because of that process that you have there, on line 3.22, it says that performance test must be done within 90 days. Is that necessary if you've gone through the other permitting getting up to that point?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I think this gets to the author's intent about when they want that there. Obviously, if pollution control equipment needs to be performance tested, if we see it as part of opening up the action, we want to see that, and that is a condition of some permits.
Thank you.
Very good.
If I might just comment on that specific piece, Mr. Chair, this is largely because of the continued failure of pollution control equipment in Water Gremlin and not testing every time and not being able to understand that the pollution control equipment wasn't working correctly. and then having this long time, long period where we had the emissions happening.
Thank you for that, and I think that's a good point, that this bill's in front of us because we had some bad actors, and we need to look at our permitting system, and the permits are going to be evaluated, and those that need attention will get attention, and those that don't likely won't, it looks to me like. That the way it looks to me like it's set up, and I date myself, but I'm going to say it seems to me like we've got a trust but verify going on here. And, you know, we trust folks to do the right thing. If they don't, then we have to do something different to protect human health. So seeing nobody else on the list here, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3377 be referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Aye. Ayes have it. Motion prevails. Okay. Representative Wasluik, we have House File 3378. Hang on a second here. Okay. House File 3378. I'm going to move House File 3378 to be approved and referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance. Representative Wasluik, would you please tell us about House File 3378?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 3378 came out of concerns that came up in discussions with community members around the lack of public engagement, specifically regarding community input into agreements that MPCA signs with companies, sometimes known as stipulation agreements, in the case of Water Gremlin, known as a stipulation agreement. I think in the opening testimony I had from the neighborhood group, there was a mention of 1,500 trees being planted, and that was a part of the stipulation agreement that happened, that was part of the stipulation agreement that MPCA and Water Gremlin signed. And through further conversations with community members, it was expressed that, again, while planting trees is a great, lovely thing to do, it really didn't have an impact on the biggest concerns that folks in the community had, that they wanted to see some sort of conversation around what would the community like to see. The community members were the ones who were impacted by the emissions, and they wanted to see something in the stipulation agreement that would have one, get their input on it, but also really have an impact in the community beyond putting some trees in place. There were conversations around doing some sort of health impact study or something that would really help kind of figure out what sort of impact this had on the community, and there was a conversation around that as being something that they may have done if they had had input and if they had had that conversation. So community members have been very clear that there needs to be more public engagement. There were several instances during the entire process from January of last year until now where folks felt like there wasn't enough public engagement, there wasn't enough public notice. And so this is one way to try and get at that issue by having a public hearing before any sort of agreements are finalized so that community members have the opportunity to weigh in on those agreements.
Very good. Thank you for that. We have Commissioner Greta Gauthier to testify. The only name I have for testifying on the bill. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 3378. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and our Commissioner, Laura Bishop, we believe that community engagement is a key function of the agency, and we share the author's goal of providing opportunities for the public to be heard. We believe this is an important conversation, and we want to work with the legislature to continue refining and improving the agency's engagement efforts. However, as it is currently drafted, House File 3788 does pose some challenges for my agency. The requirement to hold a public hearing to inform the public of the nature and extent of alleged violations could be seen as a is a violation of state statute chapter 13.39 and case law, which has said that prior to the conclusion of an enforcement process, the conclusion being the signing of either the consent decree or the stipulation agreement by all parties, prior to the conclusion, that data is not public data. Also, public hearing, the term public hearing is concerning to us because we don't know exactly what that would require. Does that mean a formal hearing with an administrative law judge? Does that mean something else? So we would need to have that clarified. And we also want to have further conversations about how the MPCA would respond to or use any information that would be given to us by the public. So, for example, if this bill did require us to have an agreement, public hearing on before we finalize a stipulation agreement and the community voiced preferences or concerns or requirements or desires or whatever you want to call it, I don't know what the disposition would be of those, because the negotiation with the permit violator is between the permit violator and the agency. So that would be, we don't want to set up a process where people are frustrated even more. So we are always supportive of finding ways to do our work better, and we'll continue to work with the author to figure out how to and get to identify meaningful engagement opportunities. Mr. Chairman, that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. And I don't have any other testimony. Anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Don't see anybody jumping up. Questions? Members? Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Gauthier, you said in your testimony that the when you're working on your consent decree and so forth, that some of that information is not public. So online, and this would be for Mr. Eliff too, maybe, to comment. On line 1.10, it says to inform the public of the nature and extent of the alleged violations. Are the nature and the extent of the alleged violations public information at that point?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, thank you for the question. Under current law, Chapter 13, that information would not be, we would not be able to consider that information public information, is my understanding.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. I want some confirmation, and I can talk to Mr. Eliff offline, although he's very, very good at what he does. You can probably find the answer.
Mr. Chairman. If I may.
Please.
So the commissioner under Chapter 13.39, Subdivision 2A, the commissioner can make a data accessible if there is a determination that this access will either aid the law enforcement process, will promote public health or safety, and or will dispel widespread rumor or unrest. So there is an off-ramp there. We did use that promoting public health rationale in having a public meeting prior to the conclusion of our negotiation of the negotiated agreement with the Water Gremlin Company. We did not focus in that hearing on the nature and extent of the alleged violations. We focused on the public health implications and the public health concerns, and had the Department of Health there to present. Quite a bit of that presentation was them, not us. So we have used that as a way to hold a hearing, but in those hearings we do not disclose detailed information about violations or anything like that. We used it to talk about public health to the community.
Thank you. And just a quick question, and that would include likely that the health department talking about potential human exposure to chemical X or whatever?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the health department talked about the work that they had done and what their parameters they had formed based on research, and then they could share that information with the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Representative
Heintzman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just remind me where this bill is going?
Going to Environment Finance. That's the motion. Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gauthier, have you considered asking the legislature to broaden the exceptions in any way so that citizens who are impacted will know more?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, thank you for the question. I don't know that I can say definitively what discussions have gone on at the agency and what have not. We have had many, many, many discussions about the implications of the water gremlin situation and the northern metals situation. But I don't know, I have not been present when we have discussed specifically what you are asking.
Representative Wagenius.
Before you come to the Finance Committee, it would be helpful if you all would think about not using the law as a barrier to talk to citizens, but figuring out a way that the law could be used as a way to share with citizens.
If you give me a second here, we actually introduced legislation somewhere along those lines last session. If you give me a second to pull it up, I can, unless you want to talk about it.
I can say something while you're doing that.
Commissioner Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. So I understand what you're saying, and please also understand from our perspective that the negotiations to do a stipulation agreement or a consent decree, those are voluntary on the part of the permittee. So they can decide not to do that, in which case we would then have to take them to court. And if we have to take them to court, then it will take a lot longer for us to get resolution to the situation for the community. So we are always trying to balance.
Representative Wagenius.
It costs the taxpayers more.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, the folks who did the harm also have to balance. And their balance would be, do we really want to go to court? Because a court could impose much, much, much stiffer fines than has been your pattern. So if I were sitting on that other side, I think I would observe or look at the balance differently. So I still would ask my question, can you look at the exceptions and see if there is a way to make an exception that would work better for the community. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, of course we can.
Thank you.
And if I can just follow up, House File 2382 introduced last session is actually adding a section into that that says facilitate community awareness of preparedness for or response to release or threatened release into the environment of a hazardous substance or a pollutant or contaminant as those terms are defined in section 115B.02. So we did have legislation on that last session to try and have more circumstances where we could have some of that information out there.
This would be a good thing to hear about as we come to Finance Committee. Is that all right?
Very good. Any further comments, questions? I think I already asked for audience on this regarding the bill. If not, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3378 be referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Members, we're going to take a five-minute recess. Please come back as promptly as you can. We've got a couple more bills to hear, so. we'll recess.
So do I.
Members, we're going to come back to order here and a couple more bills to hear. And I understand there have been some reason why Representative Becker Finn needs to present the bills for Representative Claflin. So we're going to go to House File 3180, Representative Becker Finn. And I'm going to move that House File 3180 be referred
Mr. Chair.
To Environment Natural Resource Finance.
3181.
I'm sorry, did I get the wrong one?
Yep.
Okay, I take it all back. We're going to... I'm going to we're going to do 3181, and Chair Hansen, would you like to move 3181?
I would move House File 3181 and refer it to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, very good, very good. Heard the motion. Please proceed. Tell us about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a bill that would prohibit the use of what are commonly referred to as disposable wipes free from being labeled or advertised as flushable or safe for sewers. And I'm going to turn it over right away to our first testifier, and he can explain why we need this bill.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate the committee taking time to look at this issue. This bill is pretty straightforward. There are products that we've all seen, we've all used, that are various types of wipes that are used for hygiene purposes primarily or for cleaning. And some of them have been designed in a way that they break apart very easily in circulating water, like a toilet paper would. Many of them do not. And the problem we have is the impacts that those cause when they go into a sewer system. You're going to hear from a couple city officials that can give you details on that, so I'll leave that for them. I do want to stress is that what we are doing in this bill is asking for a labeling requirement. We're not asking for a restriction on the product. And the labeling is the exact same labeling that the industry recommends its people use already, but it's voluntary for them. It's the same label and the same standards that they already use, and we are just asking that it be mandatory instead of voluntary, because our only way to address this as city utilities is to educate the public. And we can't tell people which products are safe to use and flush and which ones are not if they are not properly labeled, whether they are safe to flush or not. So that's all this does, is ask that we have that consistency of information so that city utilities can then go forward and explain to people how to best manage these products in their own homes. Mr. Chair, that's the basics of what the bill does. This is an issue that affects every size city in the state. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars in many of these cities every year, millions of dollars across the state every year, And it affects every system from the smallest to the biggest, and I'll let our testifiers speak to that, Mr. Chair, to save time.
Very good. Thank you. And we do have...
Be here for questions, if any.
Yes, sir. We do have a number of testifiers lined up here. Mike Cuno? Am I right here?
Actually, in place of Mike, my name is Frank Stemke. Oh. I will testify first.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for listening to us today, this evening, I guess. My name is Frank Stemke. I've worked in the utility industry for 28 years. The past 16 years, I have worked in the wastewater direct industry as a trainer, as a technical advisor for Minnesota Rural Water Association based out of Elbow Lake, Minnesota. I just want to share a message in today's hearing, or this evening's hearing, of how disposable wipes in the industry have changed the way utilities do business. In the wastewater collection systems and at treatment facilities, I would say that started probably in about the era of 2005 in Minnesota. Rural and populated communities have had to spend millions of dollars to adapt to deal with the wipe industry. Worldwide pump manufacturers have had to change and evolve the way they build their own pumps to deal with these, and oftentimes unsuccessful with the so-called disposable wipe. Some of the adaptations, so I'm going to give you kind of an overview from a 30,000-foot view representing all 852 communities or incorporated communities in Minnesota. Some of the adaptations that many communities have needed to add or go through during an upgrading of wastewater treatment collection systems or pump stations are as follows. Some of these can be kind of depictive of how they sound: sewer chewers, muffin monsters, pump stations, from sump baskets to cranes, weekly removing these wipes, oftentimes costing 20 to 25% more in upgrades to their sanitary sewer collection system. What happens when these are chewed up in the collection system, they oftentimes form balls and strings, very long and lengthy, kind of gross looking, oftentimes resembling, if anybody recalls, the Addams Family Cousin It. So you pull a pump out, there's huge rags that have wound and woven in after even being somewhat treated, letting us know that they are not dissolvable. So utilities have had to adapt and change, which is very costly. Oftentimes these cranes pulling these pumps up from depths of 15 to 30 feet to unravel a 3 to 6 foot woven wipe, obviously to prevent a major catastrophic sewer backup, which oftentimes can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars within minutes. So our utility industries have had to change their ways, very costly. Expensive real-time SCADA systems have been installed even in rural remote areas of the state. And why? Because we need 24/7 communication with this pump station, oftentimes because pumps plug, and we're trying to avoid, obviously, catastrophic backups. I think it's important to bring you guys, or this group, lawmakers, this extremely expensive topic. And Mr. Speaker and committee, I want to thank you for listening to these important topics as I speak on behalf of all 853 incorporated communities in our great state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Again, I've got a list here, and if you all have an order figured out, come on up. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Mike Cuno, Utility Operations Engineer for the City of Minnetonka. Thank you for dedicate time to this important topic and allowing me to share our experience at the City of Minnetonka. The city's sewer system operates and maintains 39 lift stations and 260 miles of sanitary sewer pipe. So imagine a pipe running from downtown St. Paul to Grand Marais. That is our sewer system in the city. Wipes are a significant contributing factor to our lift station failures and sewer backups. Our lift stations, on average, we have a pump go down in a lift station, on average, at least once a week. So what does that mean to us on an operational level? We need to send two of our staff members out for approximately half a day to pull the pump out of the lift station, clean the pump, pull the wipes out of the pump, and reinstall the pump to get that lift station back in operation. And that's best case scenario. Worst case, it can burn up a pump, it can burn up a control panel, a lot more costly alternatives. So we as a city, we've tried to be proactive. We have added grinder pumps to five of our 39 lift stations at a cost of $20,000 to $30,000 per lift station. So we're $125,000 in to outfit the rest of our lift stations. We're looking at in excess of another $1 million to add special pumps to try and grind some of these wipes. And that's just our lift stations. Looking at our gravity sewer lines, the city of Minnetonka, we're fortunate to have an adequate budget. We were able to spend $200,000 to buy a sewer jetting truck. So we can go and clean our sewer pipes with our own staff, and we do that. Right now, our 260 miles of pipe, we're on a three-year rotating cycle. So we are cleaning a third of the city's pipes every year. In addition to that, any pipes that experience a backup, we put on a six-month cycle. So we clean roughly 100 miles of pipe every year with our truck. Now that comes with a labor expense too. We are committing half of one of our sewer operators to go out in a truck every year to go out and clean that 100 miles of pipe. So it's, between lift stations, between pulling pumps at lift stations and cleaning sewer pipe, we're looking at one full-time person every year that is just dedicated to those items. And, again, we're City of Minnetonka, we're fortunate. I have 13 operators on my staff. There are a lot of cities outside of the metro area that are not as fortunate. They don't have the labor or budget to afford to do some of these things. So, I would throw out, imagine tonight after listening to this riveting testimony on on wipes in the sewer system, you get home and you walk into a house with a basement full of raw sewage. Your system is backed up. You call the city and they come out and are able to clear up the backup within an hour. But at that point, the damage is done. You have carpet and sheetrock and furniture and a furnace that all needs to be replaced. So you call the city the next day and submit a claim. Your claim is denied because the city has been proactive and has done the maintenance activity, and they are not liable for the backup. You call your homeowner's insurance because they will take care of it, right? You either turned down or weren't aware that you needed a special endorsement for sewer backup. So even though you may never have flushed a wipe down your toilet, if you have neighbors that aren't as diligent as you, that could cause a backup, and you are on the hook for $10,000 to $20,000 in sewer damages to replace everything in your basement. So it's a real issue. Honestly, from a utilities and public works perspective, that is one of the worst phone calls that you can get is from a resident that has a sewer backup. So I really appreciate you having us here, giving us this opportunity. We're not here asking for any money to go out and try and remedy the situation. We are just asking for your help to improve the labels, to put a clear and concise label on these products so that we can, to really help us educate the public on what should and should not be flushed down the system. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you. Got a couple more on my list here. Gretel Lee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gretel Lee. I'm stepping in for Tim Gradke today. I am here on behalf of the 100-plus cities in Greater Minnesota that comprise the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And in the interest of time, I'm going to keep my testimony really short. I agree with everything that the three gentlemen before me said. This is a really important issue for all of our members. This is something that costs them a lot of money. It costs them a lot of maintenance hours. And despite their best efforts to adapt, as Ms. Samke and Mr. Kuno said, this is an issue that continues to happen. We're continuing to see the consequences across the state, and we urge the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Tony Quillis. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I sit before you again as the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And just to make a couple of brief points on the bill, Mr. Chairman, the industry is aware of the issue and is working on it. If you'll look in your packet, should be included in there is a code of practice. Started the first version was in 2013 and was updated. The second edition was in 2017. That document was put together with input from major North American water and wastewater associations. And there's two important takeaways from that document. I just wanted to point them out very quickly, and they're bolded on page one. But it's an industry standard and their code of practice that only wipes designed to come in contact with human waste or related germs while in the bathroom be considered for disposal via toilet. And the second bullet point there, Mr. Chairman, is that baby wipes generally intended to be used by a parent or an infant disposed of with a diaper or a nappy should not be marketed as flushable. So those are those two bullet points that are I wanted to point out from the most recent code of practice by the industry. Mr. Chairman, also, if you'll flip back, I think, onto page five of, or on page two of that packet, it sets up a decision tree there on how these products should go through and whether they should be labeled flushable or non-flushable. And then also on page five, it sets up the industry standard for the do not flush symbol, where it should be located on the package, on the product, and also, if you want to, the optional Tidy Man symbol also could be included on the packet, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to point that out. Industry is always willing to work with cities and wastewater authorities to set up education campaigns because education is the key, Mr. Chairman. And composition studies show that. If you look, it's also the color handout in your packet as far back as 2011 and as recently as 2019, composition studies done show that non-flushable baby wipes, paper towels, feminine hygiene products, and other things are what's causing, I'll call them the polar bears. I forgot what we were nicknaming them before, but I'll call them the polar bears, Mr. Chairman, and that flushable wipes are 1% on the most recent composition study, Mr. Chairman. Very important part of that education is tailoring it and making sure that you use social media, bill inserts, flyers. And a great example of that was Portland, Maine had an award-winning program. It was called Save the Pipes, Don't Flush the Baby Wipes. They did a composition study before this intense education program and then after, and they had a 40% reduction before and after those studies. And, Mr. Chairman, one final point is in your packets also is it won't be a handout, but it is, I have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Disposable Wipes Toolkit on how to persuade people not to flush. And it talks about communication basics, there's no silver bullet, key messages, and how to spread that message out. And I think this is a great way to do it that the PCA has on their website, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, there are two letters in your packet. One from the Association of Nonwoven Fabrics Industry, and then also from the Household Commercial Products Association, Mr. Chairman. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Quillis. Hang on here. Representative Gomez, do you have a question for Mr. Quillis?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Quillis, I'm just wondering, you talked about you know, the importance of kind of public education campaigns, and I'm wondering if the industry is stepping up to fund these campaigns so that the, you know, taxpayers in our general fund isn't paying for the, you know, the education necessary to mitigate the damage of this product that companies are making money on.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gomez, I don't know for sure, but I want to say there was a financial commitment by the industry when working with the cities and the wastewater authorities.
Okay. Suffice to say, Mr. Quillis, that the proper labeling will help.
Mr. Chairman, I think this takes us to the old adage, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. If you, can, you label,
if you give them a little salt first, and then they drink the beet hack, though, just so you know. I got horses.
It has to do with the context on where the product is used, I think, is where the situation is. And that's why I think this code of practice by the industry is trying to straighten that out, that if you use it there, don't flush. But as much as we try to, it's us as individuals on what we do with the product.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will point out, as I'm looking at this single-spaced, very large document trying to tell me what things are flushable and what things aren't, it's still not clear to me whether a face wipe that you use to remove makeup in the bathroom is included. I don't know if folks on this committee are aware of boogie wipes, but that would be another product that a lot of families use with small kids, and it's not clear. So I also did also want to point out that tampons have been around a really long time, and we haven't been hearing from cities about the need to educate about flushing those, that this is a new issue since wipes have come on the market. So
Representative Gomez, I don't know if I cut you off. Did you have a follow-up?
I don't. I guess I just it's the assurance didn't seem very strong, I guess, is all I will say. You're like, well, I think so. So I appreciate it, but I guess, I'm just saying kind of like
I will.
It's a problem that that industry has created, that they're making a bunch of money on this product that's causing all these externalities that the public has to deal with, that it's the responsibility of industry to step up and fund the necessary activities that government is required to do. So that's my opinion on it. Thank you.
Mr. Quillis. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gomez, I will follow up to make sure that industry funds that. Like I said, I think so, but I don't. I want to make sure that that happens. And I also want to draw your attention back to the composition studies, that it's not the flushable wipes that are causing the problem. Mr. Chairman.
As always, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman.
I have one more testifier signed up, Dana Vandersmott, MPCA. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dana Vanderbosch, and I am a director of the Municipal Division at the Pollution Control Agency, so wastewater permitting occurs within my division. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 3181. In our work with wastewater operators across the state, the Pollution Control Agency has heard over and over again very similar stories to the ones that you're hearing here tonight about how costly the practice of flushing these wipes can be for cities, and ultimately for ratepayers and taxpayers who already shoulder the cost of replacing aging infrastructure. These costs include staff time, investments in new equipment, as well as the cost of hauling away and landfilling the material that come out of these clogs. And the result is that cities have to divert scarce resources away from planned maintenance that they were hoping to do on their infrastructure to deal with these emergency situations. So the MPCA shares the author's interest in addressing this burden for cities so that funds can be spent on more long-term and planned maintenance of their infrastructure. This is a good bill. It addresses a really costly problem for Minnesota cities, and providing accurate labeling is one way to help to provide consumers with correct information about what can be flushed and what can't be flushed. And so we appreciate the committee's time to hear this bill tonight.
Thank you. Who have anyone in the audience that wants to testify on House File 3181? I don't see anybody coming forward here. Any other comments, questions, members? Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this all makes sense, obviously. We don't want to, the unflushables that get flushed really cause a big problem. There's no question about that. And I've got a whole bunch of small cities and sanitary districts throughout my district that fight with this stuff every day. I get, but my little, not a concern, but just a question is MPCA, obviously they've got a technical issue here as to what the result is. They understand pumps and sanitary systems, but don't we have other agencies, Department of Commerce, that would regulate labeling and consumer products? I'm just wondering if they're missing in here or were they looked at and intentionally, nope, they don't play in this world?
Mr. Chair, and obviously I'm not the chief author of the bill, but I can tell you that the first stop for this bill was the Commerce Committee, so I assume any commerce-related issues were discussed at that point.
Thank you for that, Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Becker-Finn, I appreciate that, but I think back to Representative Lewick's comment is, why is MPCA doing this? This is kind of out of their area of expertise and so forth. This should be the Department of Commerce that should be doing this, not MPCA. Does MPCA want the authority to approve the labeling and so forth and go outside of their general business? So I'm asking MPCA directly to come to the table. And
we have somebody that wants to take that.
We've lost somebody.
Welcome back, Commissioner Gauthier. Did you hear the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I did, but maybe it'd be good to have it repeated anyway. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know, first of all, does MPCA, do they have any authority over any other kind of labeling that goes on that you're aware of, Ms. Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I am not aware of that. But I would note, Mr. Chairman, that on line 1.5, it looks like this bill would be put in Chapter 325E. So that is normally not our statute that it's really, I don't know. I mean, I can tell you, we kind of look at that sometimes as kind of a no man's land statute. It's not definitely any one agency statute. There's lots of stuff in 325, just saying. We don't see this as being in our statutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That statute sounds a little bit like a wastewater treatment facility, but whatever. So to the people from the state, and listen, I appreciate what's going on here. Don't get me wrong. I would ask the League and the Coalition and the gentleman from Minnetonka if the colored document that was handed out is accurate in terms of the percentage of materials that are appearing in the systems.
Please introduce yourself again. And did you hear the question? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, I would just point out that this came from Jacksonville, Florida. So I don't know that they've done tests, forensic evaluations of materials at every pump station at every city in Minnesota.
Representative Fabian.
Yeah.
To the testifier.
Did you hear the question?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and.
Mike Cunel, City of Minnetonka, Public Works. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I have seen that. I will say that we have not broken down our the clogs that we have found in our system at all. So I can't talk specifically to the percentages. I just know that wipes are a big issue with what we experience in our operations day to day. And it's across the board. It's the baby wipes, it's the non-flushable, the flushable. And I think that's the real challenge we have, is that without a label that clearly states whether or not they are flushable, you know, if some of them are marketed as flushable and someone is not sure, easiest thing to do is flush them down the toilet. So I think that's kind of the direction that we are asking for and we would like to see is just to clearly label them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I really do, and I appreciate the circumstances here, but should we be labeling a whole bunch of other products that are showing up in the wastewater, in the pumps and so forth?
Fair question. I will say that I don't know of any other products that market types of their products as flushable. I think that is the difference with these products. Some of them are labeled as flushable, while others are not, and that's where the confusion comes in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But even at that, I think you would have to agree that there are certain things that show up day after day after day after day after day, and they're very common, and they are flushed.
Yeah.
Is that not correct?
No, that is a correct statement.
Okay. So then to the bill author or the advocates for this, what are the requirements in other states in terms of labeling and so forth? Mr. Chair, I'm afraid we're going to be like 3-2 beer here or something. I don't know. You know?
Don't flush the can.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. I am not aware of another state that has put a mandatory labeling requirement in place on this product yet. The European Union has an agreement with the industry to use this labeling requirement on all products sold in the European Union. So these manufacturers are already making products that are labeled according to this requirement for sale there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any no further questions? If not, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last time the legislature saw this bill was in 2016. And it stalled or got clogged. And that's 4 long years. Think of the money that has been spent by the public to clean up the mess for 4 years. Minnesota used to have a reputation for leadership. This is a clear opportunity to do leadership, to do problem solving. It's easier to prevent the problem than it is to continue to pay to clean it up. I ask for a roll call on this bill and renew my motion to send House File 3181 to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Chair Hanson has renewed his motion. House File 3181 be referred to Judiciary and Civil Law, and a roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
All right. Vice Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Lead Lewitt.
No.
Representative Acom.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Bow.
No.
Representative Claflin. Representative Fabian.
No.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Heinzman.
No.
Representative Lippert.
Yes.
Representative Lislegard.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
9 ayes and 5 nays.
You heard the roll call. Motion passes. The bill is on its way. And we have next bill up, House File 3180, also a Claflin bill, and Representative Beckerfin is going to present that as well. Let's see here. I will move that House File 3180 be referred to Environment Natural be approved and referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. Please tell us about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3180. Is regarding PFAS chemicals in food packaging. And not the first time we've talked about PFAS chemicals in the legislature. These are the class of chemicals that we commonly refer to as forever chemicals. So the same thing involved with the settlement with 3M in the East Metro, as well as the the water in the city of Bemidji, and this is the same chemical that we banned from firefighting foam and household products to protect our firefighters and children last session. So this bill would ban the use of intentionally added PFAS chemicals in food and beverage packaging.
Very good. Thank you for that. Do we have several folks who are signed up to testify? And I'd like to ask that testifiers, we're getting on time here, so if you can keep it to a couple minutes, that'd be fine. I have Dave Benke, MPCA. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Benke. I'm the director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. One of our duties is to govern solid waste management, the permitting, compliance, and enforcement of that activity. We're appreciative that you brought forward this important bill tonight that addresses both the public health as well as the environmental health concerns that exist with PFAS and intentionally added into manufacturing and food products. One of the things that we look at beyond the human consumption factor is where it ends up in the waste stream. And so if the container that the PFAS is in is recycled, that can continue the movement of the PFAS into future recycled products. So even if it's recycled, it can still stay there for additional products later on. If it's composted, and a lot of the efforts we've got going right now is concentrating on organics, a diversion, we'll end up potentially with that PFAS in the compost or in the contact water that's associated with the composting operation. That compost could potentially have an impact in terms of the marketing, and the contact water might be problematic in terms of how we handle that in the end, either sending it to a wastewater treatment facility or using it to apply on the land, depending on the choice for the compost facility. Also, if that container is finally landfilled, the PFAS may transfer into the landfill leachate, which, like the contact water, if land applied, can pass that onto the ground and potentially into the groundwater. Or if it's sent to a wastewater treatment plant, it can pass it into the plant, into the receiving surface water, potentially, if there's some treatment there. So the PCA has worked successfully in the past with the Departments of Commerce and Health on toxics and products and other things, and so we're appreciative in the enforcement end that we need to, you know, coordinate with both those two agencies as well. We've had, I think, some real successes on that end working together and have actually formed a chemicals and products interagency team that works on various things. So with that, thank you. And if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
I'm going to go to our other testifiers. But you got a question, Representative Heisman?
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
For PCA.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Benke, I have a couple of questions. You had mentioned that in some cases these food waste recyclers are land applying their leachate and solids. Is that still the case today, or is that something we used to do?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chairman and members, depending on the content of the contact water, as opposed to leachate from a landfill, the contact water can vary in terms of its chemical makeup. And so we take a look at that before the end use is determined. And so land application is still an opportunity for the composters if it meets the criteria that's set out in terms of levels. We take a look at two levels. One is the health-based value level for materials, and then one's also called an intervention limit. That intervention limit is a level that we want to make sure is below if we're going to do the land application, because that still gives us a conservative value below the health-based value, so we're well under that and aren't as concerned about use in land application or other areas.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, Director. So you mentioned that there's testing going on at these facilities that are involved in this recycling activity. I'm assuming that MPCA is involved in that testing. I'm wondering if those test results are available for me to look at. Where would I find them, online or something? They must be somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd be glad to provide those to you. We've done two things. On an annual basis, we get test results from all of our facilities in their annual reports, including landfills and the compost facilities. But also we've conducted a separate look at those contact water issues at the compost facilities and have recently compiled a report on that. We'd be glad to provide that to you.
Representative Heinchen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director, there have been a number of cases that I'm aware of. I started talking about the PFAS issue a little over a year ago, and I've had a number of folks that have contacted me with some pretty specific pointed questions. And in some cases, folks that are operating these facilities have requested the testing data from MPCA, and it hasn't been provided. Is there a reason that would have transpired?
Mr. Chairman, members, the only reason I think it would have transpired is if the data wasn't quality assured before it was ready for release. A lot of the reports that we do and looks at things in a research require a couple different chains of custody in terms of the results. I just want to make sure that those are ready for distribution and there aren't errors or other things that would compromise that data.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank
you, Director. So you mentioned that if the testing wasn't quality, that it might not be released to the folks that had maybe had their leachate tested. If that data is being used to make a determination as to whether that leachate can be land applied or not, why wouldn't that data be made available to the recycler?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure why that wouldn't be. In those cases, I think we'd want to have that done.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
What I heard, Representative Heinchen, that something about being the data being quality assured, that's what I thought I heard, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I know they don't release data until it's quality assured. They know it's good.
I understand, Mr. Chair. It's in situations where a determination is being made based on that data, you would think that the information would be available to those folks who's had their leachate tested and a determination made.
If it's been quality assured, absolutely. I would think so. I agree. And thank you for your testimony. Tony Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I'll try and be brief, Mr. Chairman. I know the evening is late. I just want to make a couple of points on House File 3180 when we talk about what the scope of what we're discussing right here. When we talk about PFAS, and even though it's down to when you'll see the on the bottom of page 1, 1.19 and 1.20, down to one fully fluorinated carbon, we had a presentation in the Legislative Water Commission as well as in Representative Fisher's Water Subcommittee that in this class of chemicals, there is over 4,000 applications of it. And when you cross that back into the definitions, Mr. Chairman, of food and beverage and also any cup, pail, foil, trays, wrappers, films, bags, tubs, it's hard to go through and find replacements for all of those, whether it be food or beverage, or for all of those packages that I just talked about. Industry is working along those lines. They have found replacements, but sometimes it works for food. It doesn't work for beverage, or sometimes it'll work in cups. Sometimes it won't work in foil. So we're working along those lines, Mr. Chairman. But also keeping in that line of thought, food packaging touches food. And when it touches food, it becomes regulated as a food additive under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And the FDA has to be, before anything can be sold or distributed, can only provide after they've provided scientific data and it's safe for its intended use. So the FDA is regulating these products. They require scientific data, and they also have what I'm going to call veto power. When they see scientific studies that come up that are peer-reviewed, they have the authority to yank off these packages, Mr. Chairman. Two other states have looked at something along these lines, Mr. Chairman, Maine being one of them and Washington being the other. Maine enacted theirs in 2019 with an effective date out to 2020.
but they also had a number of other qualifiers in there. They must identify safer alternatives. Their pollution control agency, their equivalent, must identify safer alternatives. They must be readily available. They must be sufficient quantity, must be of comparable cost. And, Mr. Chairman, I readily admit I had to look at the number of zeros were in there, but they also have an exemption for any manufacturer who sells less than $1 billion in national sales. So though that's Maine. In Washington, they only did fiber-based products, and they also did a safer alternatives assessment, evaluation alternatives. You must follow the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse guidelines. You must also look at the chemical for hazard, performance, cost, availability, and then it must be published. Those alternatives, if found, must be published for external peer review. They also set up a very intense public engagement process, including government officials, chemical manufacturers, product manufacturers, and academia and research groups, Mr. Chairman. And they also, one last thing I wanted to kind of point out here is the effective date doesn't allow what I call the manufacturer retail lag. So if this would become immediately effective on January 1st, 2021, there would still be product in the system as it was moving through. Usually we have a stop manufacturing and then sell through. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time again, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Questions? Seeing none. Anyone in the audience that's looking to testify on House File 3180? Don't see anybody jumping up.
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Clapham.
Jenna Grove from Clean Water Action was coming to testify, had to pick up a child from school project. I don't know if she's not here yet.
Do you have some, and I know you walked in on this and was going on, do you have some, some comments there that you would like to offer, Representative Clapham?
I can give comments similar to what Ms. Grove from Clean Water Action would give to the committee, and my own comments as well. That these they are a tongue twister, so the acronym is so much easier to say. But the PERT and polyfluoral alkyl substances, these PFAS chemicals, are known to cause human health risks. They're known to increase cancer risk. They're known to affect liver function, kidney function, our immune response, reproductive systems. And we know that there's science behind these studies. There are a number of different chemicals have all been shown to have these effects. And we should not be waiting for the FDA to take action on banning these from food products, from food packaging products. The FDA had evidence that PFOA and PFOS harmed human health for decades and did nothing to remove them from food and beverage packaging. So this is a place for Minnesota to take leadership and protect human health, for we know that this is a problem. And other states are looking at doing the exact same ban, removing these products from food and beverage packaging, where they do contact our food and the chemicals migrate into our food. It's especially a problem with wax fast food wrappers and with some of the takeout containers and microwave popcorn bags. And this was sort of a shock to many people in the Commerce Committee that microwave popcorn bags, as part of their grease proofing, are coated with a PFAS-containing polymer. And when you heat that up in the microwave, the PFAS can move from the lining into the oil, into the food that we're eating, and into our bodies. This also ends up in our wastewater stream. It ends up in our landfills. It ends up in our compost piles, as you've been hearing from other folks tonight. We have to address this exposure source. We know that it is in our drinking water, and we're working to clean it up from our drinking water. And this is just one more source that we can address, and it's one that does pose a risk to human health. These chemicals are used in many other products that we come into contact with, like the waterproofing on our coats, some of the stain-resistant treatments on our couches and in our carpet. But addressing such an exposure risk, like our food, is very, very important and something that we can do something about very easily. We're also working to identify some other sources of exposure, but right now this is such a high priority. We should take action right now. And again, we really should not be leaving this to the FDA to regulate. It's an opportunity for us to act in the absence of leadership.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
I think this is an important bill. I ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Yes, sir. Representative Lloyd.
Game, but thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess if we look at 2.4 here, we say the commissioner may enforce this section. So I guess I'd have a question. I mean, may, what does the MPCA say about this? I mean, are they going to? Are they going to pick this ball up and enforce it? Or this just says they may. Doesn't say they shall. Says they can coordinate with other folks. I'm just curious what this 2.4, 5, and 6 really mean.
And I'm looking for MPCA. Is still in the audience? Anybody want to address that question?
I can feel.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Janelle, Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, I just point out that this language is very similar to the enforcement language that was worked out last year for the firefighting foam ban. So I don't know if that helps and if the PCA has any additional information.
Thank you for that. And did you hear the question, Mr. Benke?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dave Benke with the PCA. I think the May allows us the flexibility to work on situations in a couple different avenues. Complaint is a one way we get information to us. You know, the whole idea of our enforcement is really to achieve compliance. So if there are other ways to achieve compliance through education and outreach and work with people to get the materials out, then we'd prefer to do that. So I think the May works. If there are complaints or if there are issues, then we would need to use the tools that we have in our toolbox.
So the May works, if I understand what you basically, I mean, I just heard a very compelling justification to jump right in the middle of this and get out there and do something about it. I'm not satisfied with the May. From a standpoint, I mean, what are you doing right now in regulating the packaging of food? As an agency.
Mr. Bay.
Mr. Chairman, the regulation of the packaging really comes down to the disposal of the products that are out there in terms of where it ends up. And I think that's why in our testimony we looked at this being an issue that ends up in our disposal stream and the need to manage it where it comes from. This would help remove that. And if it continued, I think that's where the enforcement would happen. In terms of looking at it, continued persistence in packaging for us.
I guess we also, I see we also got a letter here from American Forest and Paper Association that apparently nobody wants to talk about. And it doesn't look to me like they're particularly pleased with this bill, at least as it's written. And again, I share the author's concern for this, but it strikes me that this isn't quite ready here for prime time from a standpoint of, it's not clear to me what the agency is really willing to do. You're talking about specifically about packaging food, regulating something that I think is just a little further outside the purview, and we've heard very clearly that this is an area of Food and Drug Administration at the federal level regulates across the country. So I mean, I'm just going to tell you right up front, I'm not going to support this and appreciate a call for a roll call vote, but at least we've got the opportunity to explain why. I just don't think this bill is ready yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would actually love to talk about this letter that we got. I was actually disappointed that nobody is here to testify because I did have some questions for them. Specifically, this bill deals with intentionally added PFAS chemicals, and I would really like to know, other than my microwave popcorn, where they are intentionally adding these chemicals to our food packaging. Because I, as a parent and as someone who would rather not get cancer down the road, it would be really helpful to know where these chemicals are so that if we choose to avoid them, I know Representative Liz Lagarde loves his microwave popcorn.
I was sold at popcorn.
Right? I know. It's hard. It kind of ruins microwave popcorn for a lot of us, but it's better to know. It isn't helpful to me as a parent and a consumer to not know where they are intentionally adding these chemicals. And so I think making sure that that we aren't adding these chemicals to our food packaging just makes sense. It's the easiest route to these chemicals getting into our bodies. And again, I'm disappointed they're not here because I had a lot of questions for them.
Representative Green, and then can I come back to you?
You can do whatever you want, Mr. Green. You have the gavel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm hoping that the MPCA can answer a couple questions for me.
MPCA.
If they would come back down.
Mr. Benke, I presume. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Start off with, this seems like a pretty big task. And do you have any idea what percentages of foods are currently sold that where the packaging contains these chemicals?
Mr. Benton.
Mr. Chairman, members, we really don't.
Representative Green.
Well, thanks for being candid. I guess where are you going to start? I mean, you mentioned fast food wrappers. The way Mr. Quillis was talking, we may be looking at the plastic that wraps our hamburger we buy from the store. What else are they going to use? Paper products has been brought up. Maybe put it to you this way. Do you know what percentage of food is not packaged with some sort of these chemicals?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is similar to the first question that you asked. We're not aware of the percentage.
When did PFAS come in?
So then, Mr. Chair. So the question comes up, where do you start? And, you're talking penalties. Do you have any idea what penalties you're going to be implementing?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think we have to look at the enforcement cases on a case-by-case basis, of course, as we look at things, but this would be for intentionally into the product. And I think that's where we start to draw a line of, if it's being intentionally put there and there's a ban on that and it's no longer supposed to be there, then we would start taking a look at that. As I mentioned in the testimony, we've got a way to look at things on the back end, that is on the disposal end of things, and that's where we're finding it. And so we can start to go upstream on the likely contributors to that as we move forward and look at materials, packaging, and so forth. There is, an understanding of where it exists in different kinds of packaging and so forth. I'm not sure the percentages that are out there, but some of the products that were mentioned earlier contain that. We looked at our compostable serviceware as part of our look in terms of providing, incentives to do composting, and even in looking at that, we found it in the compostable serviceware, and had to take that off our
state contract for consideration unless it could not be in there. So we didn't want to add continually to that, you know, issue. If we're trying to compost something and then you can't use the product or have unintended consequences with the contact water or other things.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, another question. You know, when I was reading through the bill, it doesn't really specify anything except for food packaging. So microwave popcorn has been brought up. So let's suppose that they get a different bag to stick in the microwave that doesn't contain this. What about the box that it comes to the store in? Is that also included in this? Because the bill doesn't really specify that. So if you got a whole bunch of microwave popcorn in bags and it's put into another box, cardboard box, is that also something that would be classified under issuing penalties for noncompliance?
Mr. Benjamin.
Mr. Chair, I defer to the author in terms of the intent of the extent of that. We're just looking at the bill itself. I would be dealing with the food packaging in contact with the food itself.
And if I may add, Representative Green, I'm asking Ms. Taylor, is there some history on this? Other states have looked into this, that you're aware of.
Mr. Chair and members, as has already been mentioned, there are a few other states that have looked at this. The definitions are similar to those that were used in Maine. I don't know what the intent of the author is, but I don't believe, you know, all packaging would be subject to it. But as far as like some packaging, I think would be, even if it does not have direct contact with.
We have a little bit of history. And to the author, did you have a comment on this, please? Representative Clapham.
Yes, Chair and Representative Green. The food package part is just meant to be the portion that has a contact with food. There are some other definitions of what the package and packaging components could be, but we're banning the PFAS from the packaging that actually is in contact with the food.
Okay. And then just for the sake of time, one more question. And it may be in the bill and I missed it, but this just says any food that is sold in Minnesota. What about stuff that comes across the border? How would you enforce that? Would you just stop anything coming across into Minnesota that may be packaged?
Mr. Bain.
Mr. Chairman, the language is for food or packaging sold in Minnesota, and so that's where we would start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm looking at that too. When we talk about the food package, and then when you look at the definitions, and respectfully to the author, comment that it's just the packaging material that's in contact with the food, it looks to me like if you make something, hamburger popcorn, someplace and who knows where, and you put it into some cardboard boxes or a crate, that's in line 1.14, or it gets put into a shipping container, that's on line 1.13, and if you use some exterior blocking to hold the shipping container in place, or you've got some bracing, or you put some weatherproofing over the container, or some straps and some closures, that's all in the definitions. So, again, I understand the PFAS stuff. I get that. But anything that has been put in this container, no matter how many layers of stuff there are over it, is going to be subject to the bill. And that might be for staff to answer or pollution control or for the author.
I think I can help out with this. Look at line 2.2, and it said a food package. That's the prohibition against a food package. And then you turn over on 1.18, and it defines a food package. And it says 1.19, food or beverage contact. So, or used to store food. So the other definitions are kind of what it's not. So I think it's just go what we call statute tracking. And just food package 2.2 and food package 1.8.
Mr. Chair, well, I respectfully disagree, Representative Wagenius. I think that
that's fine.
The way the bill is written, it doesn't. It's clear to me that a shipping container or a crate or those things, and I guess I'd ask nonpartisan staff to give me their impression.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm looking at the definition of package, and it does include, you know, sort of a broader range, but it would. But if you look at the food package definition also, which, you know, Representative Wagenius is, it would also need to store food. So I don't know if the intent would be for like a crate, like a temporary storage, but I would say like, let's say popcorn, and this is just my reading, the box would also be subject to, you know, the individual box along with what's actually touching the corn would be subject to it, but maybe not the crate it came in. But that's just sort of my initial reading. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this bill really seriously has some work that needs to be done. Thank you.
Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Claflin, are perfluoroalkyl alkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances naturally occurring?
Representative Claflin.
No, they're all man-made.
Mr. Chair, Representative Claflin, and they last forever. Is that correct?
Representative Claflin.
Chair and Representative Hansen, they pretty much do last forever. They're made by bonds that are incredibly difficult to break. They are very, very stable in our environment, and they will not break down by just aging, decomposition.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is piggybacking on Representative Fabian, and this is something that I missed when I read the bill, but I have a question then. So food package means a package or, excuse me, line 1.8, food package means a package or packaging component intended to market, protect, or to handle a product intended for food or beverage. So let's say, for instance, you know, go back to the paper industry. You've got a box of cereal that has maybe some plastic or some type of stuff inside of it holding the cereal, but the box outside is marketing it. So would that also be included?
For Representative Platform, I assume. Mm-hmm. Representative Platform.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a number of products that do include these fluorinated compounds, and I do not know of any plain paperboard boxes that would include PFAS as any sort of grease-proofing agent. So while we may be concerned about food contact, the few Cheerios that fall out of the plastic bag into the cardboard box, we're really concerned with food or beverage contact.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I also don't believe that that this is really very clear. I think this could be a mess. We're going to have to look at, obviously, MPCA adding more staff. There's no fiscal note on it for the next committee, as I understand, and I don't think it's ready.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. Members, this effect debate of this bill is about 10 months away. And not only would affect food packaged in this state, but food offered for sale or distribution in the state. We're talking about interstate commerce here for a bill that's gonna go into effect, that could go into effect in 10 months. I would agree that it's not ready yet for prime time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as a toxicologist, I have a lot of concern about PFAS and a variety of other things that we're exposed to and our children are exposed to. So that's a big issue for me. And so from that standpoint, we need to do something. But I would agree with my peers here that I just don't think this is quite ready yet. There's a lot of fine-tuning that needs to be done. So I will likely be voting no, even though long-term I want to start to get rid of these things as well, because they're everywhere in the environment. But This one is just not ready yet, I don't believe. Thank you.
Any other? Representative Lewitt.
Just a quick comment to go a little further on the folks from the paper industry. And if you look on the page 2 of their letter there, at the second to last paragraph, their concern is that the way they read this bill, it would prohibit things that are currently allowed by FDA and approved right now. So, I just want to put that on the record. Apparently no one else will speak for that industry, but, that's what they say. And so we've not had a whole lot of luck overruling FDA on a lot of stuff. But again, I share the author's concern, but I'm going to vote against this and make it very clear why. This isn't ready, I don't believe.
Seeing no further comments, and I believe I asked for audience comments already. I believe. Anybody in the audience wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Okay. Renew my motion. House File 3180 be referred, passed and referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. And the roll call has been requested. The clerk will call the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Lee Lewick.
No.
Representative Acom.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Bow.
No.
Representative Claflin.
Aye.
Representative Fabian.
No.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hansen.
Yes.
Representative Heinzelman.
No.
Representative Lippert.
Yes.
Representative Lizegard.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
We have 9 votes in favor and 9 yes. 6 no. Motion passes. Bill's on its way to Environment Finance. Okay. And next we have a Becker Finn bill, House File 3535. Welcome back, Representative Becker Finn.
I'm back.
Please tell us about your bill.
House File 35, did we move it?
Oh, yeah, sorry about that.
I can move it. I will move that House File 3535 go to the General Register. So this is a bill. I will actually start with, this is a bill that Representative Heinzelman and I agree on. Once a biennium.
Aye. What's going on here?
I know. So this just updates our statutes regarding muzzle loaders. There's some new technology now that will hopefully make muzzle loading something that interests more hunters in our state. Specifically, everyone knows and loves Federal Premium. So they have some new technology that's going to make it easier to load your muzzle loader and kind of leave fewer things up to chance when you're hunting with a muzzle loader. It doesn't change the fact that you would still be loading from the muzzle and be under the other restrictions that currently apply. It's just making it clear that this new technology would not be askance of current statute. And I do have a couple testifiers.
Okay. Please come forward and state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is John Zinnel. Thank you for the time, committee, and Mr. Chairman. I'm the Youth and Conservation Program Manager for Federal Premium Ammunition up in Anoka, Minnesota. So we are located there for 98 years. We're coming up on our 100th anniversary, so pretty exciting there, manufacturing ammunition and components at that same facility. This partnership here with this product, there's a couple samples coming across. There is within partnership of a couple other industry veterans, Traditions Firearms and Hodgson Powder. We're also partnering in this effort for this new ignition system for a muzzleloader. Because it is a new innovation, we've completely reached out to at least half of the states so far. We're continuing down the process for the other half to talk about their current regulations to make sure that we have clarity for the end consumer and the hunter as they go out and purchase their licenses for the muzzleloader seasons. So the system steps, there's a handout in your packets. Just to go through quickly on that, just to hopefully take care of any questions that may come of that. Representative Becker Finn mentioned, you are still loading through the muzzle, which is the traditional fashion. So you engage the safety as you would with any other firearm. You load the sabot through the muzzle with your ramrod as a muzzle loading rifle. You seat that bullet or sabot firmly on the shelf that is inside of the barrel. So that is in replace of a what would normally be there would be a something called a breech plug. You open the breech by disengaging the barrel release, insert the encapsulated powder charge, which is being passed around now, into the breech end. You insert the primer, which is the igniter part of the powder. You close the breech, and now the firearm is ready to be utilized. And so that's the very quick and broad system of how that is used. Some highlights on the system. This is something that's been in the works with our engineering team for 5 to 7 years as far as new product innovation as we're moving forward with this and other new products, and safety being the number one concern here. So this takes away the opportunity to either undercharge or overcharge with your powder. It's also impervious to moisture. You can drop that on the ground. If it was happened, you could pull it back up out of water and utilize it, whereas if you're using traditional muzzleloader, obviously everybody's heard the term of keep your powder dry. You can have safety concerns and issues there with your firearm not igniting or your powder not igniting if it's got moisture in it. And also the consistency of the powder charge itself is that particular powder charge encapsulated product is manufactured in our facility in Anoka. And so it has the same tight tolerances as our ammunition does. And so you don't have to worry about having any sort of measuring concerns or issues within the powder as well. We truly believe that this is rejuvenating the muzzleloader world. It's been since the early 80s when the inline muzzleloader was established to really have some breath of fresh air within the muzzleloader world, I guess you say. And so we're pretty excited about that. And also the R3 movement. So part of my job is getting more youth and new adult onset hunters involved in the sport. And this takes out a lot of those barriers and questions that they may have of something that's intimidating. That they may not otherwise want to take part in. And so in conclusion, this clarity on the current regulations helps the end users in Minnesota and the Minnesota DNR enforce the laws in the field. And we want to thank Representative Becker Finn for authoring this bill, and we fully support it.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions with the testifier? Not at this time, apparently. So thank you. And I have it on the list, Troy Olson.
Mr. Chair, he just gave me the thumbs up that he doesn't feel like he needs to testify. Okay. I will also say that we have obviously discussed this with the DNR, with Captain Smith, and he have the DNR's blessing as far as them being okay with this language.
I've just been advised that there's a Rob Door wanting to testify. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, my name's Rob Door, and just for the record, I'm speaking on behalf of myself, not any organization that I'm affiliated with. But I had the opportunity to speak to my fellow deer hunter, Representative Becker Finn, about this technology. I actually was unaware of it, so she had the edge on me there. It's really cool. I have done muzzle loading in the past, usually after an unsuccessful regular firearms deer season. It helps extend your deer season a little bit more. And one of the struggles is the only effective way to get your charge out of your firearm is to fire your weapon. You have to fire it before you get it out. I had a situation where on a really snowy, wet day, I couldn't fire my cartridge out of my muzzle loader. I have a firing cap that goes on there, but even then, so I had wet powder in there. And so I'm driving around in my car, albeit without an ignition source, but It's rather unsettling to have a firearm loaded with powder and a projectile in there ready to go off. And this technology really helps advance that. So I think it makes it easier for people to get into the sport, especially at a time when we're looking to make things easier for younger people and expand hunting in Minnesota. And I would urge all of you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green, did you have a question?
Yeah.
For this gentleman?
No, I can go with the author.
Okay.
I actually think this is unique, and I'm not against it. But can you tell us what happens if you have an inexperienced hunter, and they load their firearm and they put the projectile in, and then they don't fire it, take the charge out, and then the next day reload it with another projectile before they fire it off? What happens?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would hope that an inexperienced hunter isn't using a firearm that they don't know how to use.
Well, I would hope that too, but I will say that that was the first thing that came up, because it could be a pretty big disaster. And like I said, I'm not against this. It's just something that is, if there's a way to get that projectile out, then there really isn't after it's rammed in there. I suppose you could ram it back out, but, you know, that would be a little bit of a concern.
I was going to say, Representative Green, that's why some of us stick with a 30-30, you know.
And or use real black powder in a muzzle loader. I like that. I like the smell.
And I'll also say, Mr. Chair, it's much easier if you actually have this specific type of muzzle loader to demonstrate, but we decided that probably wasn't the best idea. Maybe you guys will have to make some kind of toy colored one. I don't know. One that's cut in half, maybe, so you could show. But he can answer that question too.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may answer that question for you. On John Zinnel again with Federal. If you do look at the first page of my description here, my handout, you'll notice that it is a hinge action firearm. So it does hinge action, and because it does not have a breech plug, it only has that shelf within the barrel that the bullet or the sabot sets on, you can actually see clearly through this barrel. So in a matter of half of a second of opening up that firearm in order to put this capsule in, you can see down that barrel 100% all the way through, whether there's a projectile in there or not. So that's another safety aspect that this product actually has to offer.
You had some dummies look at it, and you got to figure it out.
Yeah, 7 years of engineers taking a look at this. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Other questions, comments, members? Anyone in the audience looking to testify for or against this bill? See anybody getting up? Would you like to renew your motion?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and I will also mention the muzzle loading season is late when it's colder, so I'm also not too worried about too many people. There's a couple of us really excited about it, but I don't know that we're going to be over hunting in the muzzle loading season, even with this new technology. And with that, I thank members for the support and will renew my motion that House File 3535 go to the General Register.
Very good. You heard the motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Baker-Finn.
Last but not least.
Next, we have a Lee bill. Come up, Representative Lee. House File 3342. I will move House File 3342 to be passed and referred to the General Register. Please tell us about your bill, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for the opportunity to present House File 3342. House File 3342 is about reducing the amount of lead on public hunting land. This bill is critical because the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control state that there is no level of lead exposure that is considered safe for humans. The same can be said for our wildlife. The U.S. Geological Survey recently estimated that between 6,000 and 10,000 tons annually, which is about 12 to 20 million pounds of lead, enter our nation's uplands, wetlands, and waterways each year. During the 2017 Minnesota hunting season, 178 tons of lead was deposited on state lands just during the small game hunting season. Lead is toxic, and when ingested, it can affect wildlife and human health and reproduction. and at higher levels could be fatal. Mr. Chair, House File 3342 will require hunters to use non-toxic shot for taking small game and wildlife management in wildlife management areas in the farmland zone. And I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Very good. And we do have a list here. I would ask that it looks like we got a half a dozen or more, and that's fine. But please, testifiers, keep your testimony as brief as you can. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carol Henderson, and I'm commenting as a private citizen and an avid lifetime hunter in support of the legislation House File 3342. I have hunted small game, including pheasants, since I was 10 years old, starting my hunting career with my grandfather's L.C. Smith double barrel 12 gauge, which was big for a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I've carried forward all these years as an avid hunter. I am not an anti-hunter. I am a hunter conservationist who cares about nature, about all wildlife, both game and non-game. I care about healthy habitats for wildlife and about preserving our hunting heritage and traditions. I've been using steel shot for hunting upland game for over 30 years. I have been in favor of legislation that was introduced 4 years ago that basically the same that we see now. And since that time, I estimate that another over 120 to 30 tons of lead have been deposited on our farmlands and wildlife management areas because we didn't enact the legislation at that time. Because lead is cumulative. It stays there. It doesn't rot. It doesn't degrade. It gets corroded on the surface, but it's still poison after all those years. So we're looking at a cumulative waste problem on our wildlife hunting lands. Now, some hunters and hunting organizations object to having restrictions on lead ammunition. They believe it's an attempt by anti-hunters to stop hunting, and it threatens the possibility of gun ownership, and they think it's going to take away the Second Amendment. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The people who really care about this legislation are hunters who care about their image and about the environment. Hunters can promote using non-toxic ammunition and use that to help improve their image among all publics and protect wildlife and demonstrate their long-standing role as hunter conservationists who care about healthy habitats and protecting wildlife. Also, it was just mentioned about the R3 program, that DNR has a very strong commitment to R3 recruitment for new hunters, and yet many of the publics that are being targeted are millennials, foodies, lookivores, women, and children who would be particularly offended if they thought they were going to be feeding lead pellets in their wild game meat to their families and children. And so there's a human health dimension to this, as well as impacts on wildlife. And so we're not really talking about performance of the ammunition. We're talking about the big picture of wildlife and human health as well. Now, another important question here is that for a long time, people have said, oh, steel shot is too expensive. I can't afford it. Well, this weekend, I did some online surveys of federal ammunition costs. And I came with a ballpark estimate, and Mr. Fennell can probably correct me if I'm off a little bit here, but I came up with about 88 cents per shell for steel, premium grade, 81 cents per shell for lead, 7 cents difference per shell. Now, an average pheasant hunter in Minnesota takes about just shy of 4 pheasants per year. And I'm guessing, based on my own experience, a pheasant hunter might shoot 5 times for each pheasant they get. So we're looking at a possibility of 7 cents times 20 shots. It's going to cost somebody an extra $1.30 to $1.40 a year to shoot steel rather than lead. And that's less than 1% of the total estimated cost of what a small game hunter spends per year. cost is no longer a factor. And then also, on the way to this hearing, I stopped at the local Walmart, and guess what I found? Federal produces a really nice Upland game load in the smaller pellet sizes that were not previously available. I think they came out, was it last year or a year ago? And anyway, these are number six shot, and those, these would be adaptable. They're ahead of the game. They're producing steel, and it says Upland. They're ahead of the legislation right now. The 7.5 and six would both work. I've shot a lot of pheasants with number six shot. The biggest surprise of all, though, is that at the Walmart store I was at, my cost for this box of shells was $5.94. That's less than a quarter a shell. Now, I don't know how they did that. I'm sure that's not what is advertised. Anyway, that was my little shopping trip on the way here to get the latest prices. And now a little bit more ballpark estimates here. In 2018, we had 55,000 plus pheasant hunters taking about 205,000 pheasants. That many hunters would fire over 1 million shells in the field to take that pheasant crop. And they would spread, I estimate, about 36 tons of lead on farmlands and on wildlife management areas. And often, when people go out for pheasants late in the fall on wildlife management areas, you know where they're hunting? Right in the cattails, right next to the marsh, because that's where the roosters are. And then how many of those shots are going to go out into the marsh where it's not legal to shoot lead for waterfowl, but if you call it a rooster pheasant, then it's legal. That's a real disconnect in terms of our standards. But the biggest thing that I think needs to be looked at in the long term is that our public wildlife management areas are lead shot dumping grounds, where if we're adding 30 to 40 tons of lead per year, that's not necessary because that lead stays toxic forever. The lead shot I fired on our family farm when I was growing up is still there. It doesn't go away. It's always toxic. And so I guess there are four things I'll leave you with. This legislation is important to preserve the role of hunters as conservationists. Number two, it's important to protect wildlife, both game and non-game, from lead poisoning. Number three, to end the deposition of lead on our wildlife management areas. And four, to protect human health. Four simple highlights that would go along with this legislation. I hope it passes this time. And I think that if we look at the broad societal benefits, in 2015, the State Senate Research Committee did a survey at the state fair, and they found out that 73% of the public believed lead ammunition should be phased out on all public lands. Well, that was 5 years ago. After all of the negative publicity that keeps coming about lead, I would suspect it's a lot higher now. And hopefully we can bring this type of legislation to passage. It will be good for hunters, hunting traditions, wildlife, everything from pheasants to eagles, and our family meals, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Representative Fabian.
I have a question for Mr. Henderson.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair. Do you still have that L.C. Smith double barrel?
I sure do.
Oh.
That's a family treasure. My grandpa bought it in 1912, and it still works. Oh, that brings up one important issue. In the amendment, it mentions steel, but if you want to shoot an old double, nowadays, you need special loads with bismuth. It would be probably worthwhile to amend bismuth into the list of acceptable shot. Thank you for the question.
So noted. Thank you, Mr. Henry.
My son's never had
okay.
That one.
Next on our list here, Luis Ramirez. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Luis Ramirez. I'm the Director of Conservation with Audubon, Minnesota. and I'm here to express Audubon Minnesota support of this bill. It's for many years, science has documented really well the impact of lead in the environment and how this neurotoxin decreased the biodiversity of many areas. So that is why we are very supportive of this bill, especially in these wildlife management areas that are very important for biodiversity, but also are the program of important bird areas usually are connected to these protected areas. So in general, we estimate that around 170,000 acres of good bird habitat is included in these wildlife management areas. Also, for many years, since 2006, Audubon has been involved in these type of initiatives, and we are happy to see these kind of bills coming back into place. We acknowledge the importance that hunters are key for conservation, that most of the work or a big part of the work that has been done across the country is because of the help of hunters, but we see these type of opportunities like as a option for hunters to become even more of a factor in conservation and increasing biodiversity. So that is why we like to support this bill, and we hope that these type of ideas keep moving forward.
Very good, thank you. Seeing no questions here, thank you for your testimony. I have on the list here Colette Adkins. Okay, maybe that's, okay, we've got some written, there was something to pass out, so evidently that's going to suffice for Ms. Adkins. So John Zinnel. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Again, John Zinnel with Federal Premium Ammunition, Youth Program and Conservation Program Manager for Federal and CCI Ammunition. Again, I plan to keep my remarks short. Federal Ammunition has been manufacturing ammunition for 98 years at its Anoka facility. We manufacture both lead and non-lead products at that facility. The majority of our products are lead-based, over 90% of those products. Nearly all of the lead within those products comes from another Minnesota facility in the South Metro, and the majority or almost all of that lead is coming from recycled batteries or tire weights. So all of the lead products that we're pushing out of our facility comes from a recycled product with another Minnesota company. Our stance as a company has always been it's the hunter's choice. We manufacture both products, and as the world's largest ammunition manufacturer, we'll continue to do so. We believe a regulatory approach will only add additional hurdles to the already declining hunting population. This means less jobs in Anoka, Minnesota, higher costs at the sporting goods stores, and less license sales for those state agencies. Less sales of our products means less PR excise tax dollars to support wildlife and wild places as well. In conclusion, traditional ammunition plays a large role on many facets, including the 1,500 jobs in Anoka, and Federal opposes this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Zinnel. Seeing no questions, thank you. Troy Olson, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Troy Olson, representing the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the trade association for firearms and ammunition manufacturers. NSSF opposes House File 3342 and maintains that removing traditional ammunition as a choice for hunters creates barriers to hunting and hinders hunter recruitment, retention, and reactivation efforts that so many groups in Minnesota are undertaking right now, including the DNR. If hunter numbers decline, so will funding for wildlife management as the excise tax dollars collected from ammunition and firearm manufacturers is the largest source of conservation funding in America. This funding has helped to lead the way to the recovery of many species in Minnesota and the U.S. These populations have recovered with the sale of traditional ammunition, not in spite of it. Attempts to remove access to traditional ammunition have been shown to inhibit access to hunting, which will hurt Minnesota directly in loss of license fees and indirectly in decreased ammunition sales, which leads to a loss of conservation dollars. NSSF asks the committee to support ammunition choice for hunters and please oppose House File 3342.
Thanks for your testimony. Any no questions? Thank you. Nels Paulson.
Good evening, committee members. I'll try and keep my remarks pretty brief. I know it's getting pretty late. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Nels Paulson. I'm the policy director at Conservation Minnesota. And for many, many years, the members of Conservation Minnesota have told us that they want Minnesota to be a leader on getting lead out of both the built environment and the natural environment. And the 2018 study by the Minnesota DNR that Representative Lee referenced in his remarks showed us that there's a significant amount of lead deposition on our WMAs, particularly in the farmland zone. And Representative Lee's bill starts to address this issue, which we fully support. For decades, Minnesota hunters have had a strong conservation ethic, and I urge your support of House File 3342 to show the public, and that's both the hunting public and the non-hunting public, that Minnesota hunters still have that strong conservation ethic going forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions. Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Aaron Clement.
Good evening, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Clems with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and in the interest of keeping things brief, refer to just the fact sheet that was distributed to the committee members and also Dr. Ramirez's testimony as well as Mr. Henderson, I'm sorry. Our belief is that we've got to start reducing the amount of lead deposited in our lands. This is a good place to start, and we hope that you'll consider that and pass the bill. So thank you very much, and we thank Representative Lee for bringing it forward.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions. Thank you, Mr. Clem. Howard Goldman. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Goldman, and I'm here representing Friends of Scientific and Natural Areas in the state of Minnesota. And we support the bill. Friends was established in 2012 to protect SNAs, which are areas that are set aside with unique habitats for plant communities and wildlife species. We want to ensure that these areas remain protected and managed and perpetuated. In 2019, we organized led a petition to prohibit the use of lead ammunition and lead fishing tackle in the state. 16 groups signed on, and amongst those groups were the commissioners, the DNR commissioners, Citizens Council, the Ornithologist Union, the Herpetological Society, Friends of the Mississippi, and Isaac Walton League, and many others. Now, as we've discussed, studies clearly indicate that lead is toxic to humans. It's also toxic to eagles. 90% of the bald eagles that are treated at the Raptor Center have elevated blood levels, and 25% die every year. And over the past 25 years, over 500 eagles have died at the Raptor Center because of lead. The Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge that is managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service has examined done autopsies on hundreds of eagles over the past several years. They concluded that lead is one of the leading causes of eagle mortality. We think it's time to ban lead ammunition All the voluntary efforts thus far have failed, and we urge you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Seeing no questions, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that looking to testify? Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Rob Doerr. I'm the political director of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. And while the Gun Owners Caucus has opposed this bill in the past, we're not taking a position on it this year. Some of the concerns that we have are what we've seen in other states with the, it's starting off with smaller areas, though I wouldn't call this small. The vast majority of wildlife management areas are in the farmland zone, and the farmland zone covers 2/3 of the state. And so while it's not a small area, the impact of this expanding to all hunting, or even in some states' cases, even private land and for shooting ranges, that has us greatly concerned to see the expansion of that. I think it's also important to realize that that 2018 study by the DNR also showed that there is no link to population level impact on animal species because of lead, the use of lead shot. So while there isn't any debate that lead is toxic, it's very much unclear, or it's very much clear that there's not having a population-wide impact on animal species here in Minnesota and in many other states. In fact, in Minnesota, the bald eagle population has been soaring, pardon the pun, over the last decades. And the final thing I want to talk about is keep in mind, too, that hunting is a constitutional right here in Minnesota. It is in our state constitution that we have the ability to hunt and fish. And as we are looking to expand the ability for or reach out to new hunters and things like that, we also need to keep in mind that it's typically people of lower means, less income, that use wildlife management areas. They don't have the money to go to a game preserve and hunt there, or use, you know, they don't have acres and acres of private land. It's typically people who are either just getting into the sport of hunting or people who don't have a whole lot of money that use these public lands. Steel does not perform the same as lead shot does. In order to get this similar performance, you need to go up to denser metals like tungsten. And my son, I've got a picture of him here because I'm shameless. There he is with his first pheasant. It took me going to 4 local shops to find non-toxic ammo for him, and 4 different shots trying to get it. When I finally found tungsten ammo, it was $7 a round for his 410 shotgun. 410 is a less common round, but it's something that a 10-year-old can handle. It's $7 a round. That adds up, especially when you want them to actually practice with that ammunition to be able to be familiar with it. It really adds up, and I think it's going to have a disproportionate impact on those who are just getting into the sport, which is who we really need to reach out to the most. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope federal is still here so they know that there's demand for more 410 ammo now that it's legal.
For turkey.
Good. Thanks for your testimony. Anybody else looking to testify? Introduce yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Pat Riddick. I was the founder and former director of the Raptor Center that Mr. Goldman was talking about a little while ago. I'm now since retired and have no longer much in the way of any association with them, but I want to put a face on these eagles that are dying of lead poisoning. You know, we talk about no population effect, but I'll tell you what, for that one individual eagle that's got lead poisoning, and I've had over 600 of them that I've dealt with. Most of them had to be euthanized because they were so severely intoxicated with lead. They are seizuring, they are screaming in pain, they are dying a terrible death. And those are the ones that came into the clinic. I don't know how many more are left in the wild that we never recover. But this lead is toxic. It's a serious problem. It causes undue, inhumane death to an awful lot of animals out there, and it can be, it's entirely preventable because we have the means to do it. I've been dealing with this for 45 years. Carol Henderson and I have worked our whole careers dealing with lead poisoning in one species of animal or another, whether it's eagles, swans, other raptors, and you know, we keep coming here, these same tired arguments about having negative impact on hunting and recruitment and performance and all this stuff. You know, our technology is such that we can and have overcome most of these things. The cost differential, except for 410s, is not significant. That's been proven over and over again. And it's really time to do something about this. It's a serious, serious problem, and it's collateral damage. It doesn't have to happen, and we can prevent it, and we should. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. No questions? Anybody else looking to testify? I think we run out of testifiers. So, final comments, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for the opportunity to present House File 3342, and I urge your support.
Very good. So, with no further comments or questions, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3342 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Lee. Let's see, what else we got to do tonight? We're adjourned.